NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning into another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad to be behind the microphone with you. Got a great show for you this afternoon. Cameron Gray down at the American Legislative Exchange Council conference in New Orleans. You'll hear his interview with Stephen Moore, economist with the Heritage Foundation. Also, Saul Anuzis from 60 Plus down at the ALEC convention. We'll chat with Jeff Hammond, Hollywood Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports, about the upcoming Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race, which is going to take place next Saturday. Cannot wait. Next Friday night. Get done with the show a week from today, and I head down in my car. You're going to be down there, are you not, John Pop?
You know it, man. I am so ready. I got my Bristol mug over here ready to go. I can't move it too close, Cam, because I spilled my Bristol mug full of coffee on my laptop yesterday. I was so excited when I pulled the mic over.
Oh, dear.
So I meant kind of on, but yes, it's right here. I'm so ready. It's ridiculous. We're getting into the final details, getting us where we're going to stay, where we're going to go. We got to get our golf cart, you know, all that important stuff. You know, our barbecue.
Absolutely.
You know, the details.
Oh, the barbecue. Oh, I absolutely cannot wait. And I just realized, looking at myself in the monitor there, that I forgot to take off my off-air hat. This hat is a little dirty and old and usually doesn't make it on the air. But
I like it.
Whoops.
We'll switch. What's the logo, by the way?
That's the old logo of the Nashville Sounds.
Cam, someday I want to do a whole feature just on all the different hats and teams that you have, because I find it fascinating. I love it. I try to look at the logos and figure out what is going on there. So,
gotta love small town America. But yes, this is my yard work hat. So it's a little faded and has been freshly washed. Well, fairly recently, anyway. All right, so we're gonna head down to New Orleans. Let's get back on track. And you'll hear from Cameron Gray, Saul Anuzis, and Stephen Moore. I mentioned Hollywood Jeff Hammond's going to join us. Sean Maloney is going to be with us as well, coming up in Hour 3 from Buckeye Farms Association. We'll talk about a story out of Chesapeake, Ohio, where the fire chief has resigned because the city council said no longer can members of the fire department carry firearms when they're on the job. And the chief said, well, if you're telling me I can't do this, apparently the city council said, look, it's going to cost us an extra $2,500 to insure the fire department for its members carrying firearms. Not $2,500 per firefighter, just $2,500. And the city council said, we just can't find the money. Maybe that's the case. Maybe that's the case. But the fire chief said, well, if you can't insure my safety, and a lot of times when we're rolling up on calls these days, and we're treating an overdose patient, for example, we may be getting there to the scene before police do. And we really don't know what we're going to find. Maybe that everything's fine and we're able to use Narcan to revive that person and they're relieved that they're alive and they're happy to see us. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes these individuals come back and they come back very violently. We also don't know the other individuals who might be on scene. And so the fire chief said, I'm stepping down. The assistant chief, who's now the interim chief, says he'll abide by this new policy, but he doesn't like it, neither do the other firefighters. They say, again, this is a matter of public safety, and they're going to continue lobbying the city. But we'll talk about this with Sean Maloney, the Buckeye Farms Association. You know, Ohio, like every state in the country, has been hit hard by the opioid epidemic. But there are some states that have been hit harder than others. Ohio is one of them. And I don't doubt that these firefighters are carrying, because there have been times where they felt like they've needed to for their own safety. And the city council says, look, we just don't have the cash, don't have the $2,500. Still amazes me. But we'll get into that a little bit with Sean Maloney coming up in Hour 3. Tony Katz going to join us in Hour 3 as well from Indianapolis, Indiana. Charles Cook from National Review is going to be with us. They've got a whole issue devoted to the Second Amendment out on newsstands right now. And we'll chat with Charles about what is contained in the pages of the latest National Review. Plus, we have our hero of the day, We have our deal of the day. So we've got a couple of deals of the days. And we've got our good guy coming up as well. Plus, of course, all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including from Chicago, where last weekend, once again, a very, very violent weekend. Hoping that this weekend is different in Chicago, but not expecting it to be much different. And the Chicago Sun-Times has an op-ed today by J.B. Pritzker on the violence in Illinois and in Chicago in particular. It's called Gun Control, Stronger Communities, and Ending the Violence Epidemic. J.B. Pritzker says, our communities are strong and resilient. Our families are striving for something better, but many are running up against entrench barriers of systemic racism and disinvestment, and for too long, leadership in Illinois has been just another impediment. He says it's time to change that. By the way, I believe J.B. Pritzker is running for office. Yes, he is the Democratic candidate for governor in Illinois. So just keep that in mind as we read this op-ed here. J.B. Pritzker says, it's time that we address gun violence as we would treat a public health epidemic. Like treating a disease, we need to interrupt gun violence, reduce the risk of it spreading, and prevent it by building safer and healthier communities. Now, it's interesting. I noted this a couple weeks ago up in Canada when there were calls to treat gun violence as a public health issue. Their answer was, well, we need to ban handguns. If we're going to treat gun violence is a public health issue, we need to ban handguns. There's no reason anybody should own a handgun here in Canada. That was their answer for treating violent crime as a public health issue. Now, Canada's also dealing with an opioid crisis. They've got record high numbers of overdoses. Same province, Toronto, Canada, some of the same officials, as a matter of fact, who said the way to treat gun violence as a public health issue is to criminalize the ownership, all ownership of handguns. Their answer for treating the opioid epidemic, which, by the way, is killing more people in Canada and the United States than homicides right now, their answer to treat the opioid epidemic as a public health issue was to decriminalize all drugs. So I got to say, I'm a little confused here how treating guns as a public health issue or gun violence as a public health issue means we have to ban all the guns. And treating drugs and drug overdoses as a public health issue, the answer is, well, we've got to legalize all the drugs. I'm not sure I really understand her because it kind of sounds like you're just using public health as an excuse to do what you already want to do. Ban guns or decriminalize all drugs. And again, you want to make those arguments, okay, but just claiming public health doesn't actually make an argument. J.B. Pritzker says, without a doubt, we need common sense and long overdue gun safety legislation. Criminals and those who want to do harm shouldn't have access to guns, and no one should have access to, quote, weapons of war or be able to obtain guns illegally. Now, let's stop there for just a second. No one should be able to obtain X illegally. Doesn't have to be guns. It could be alcohol. In the Soviet Union, it could have been Levi jeans. Or Led Zeppelin records. Nobody should be able to obtain X illegally. So J.B. Pritzker says, we're going to shut down the black market. I think it's great. But how are you going to do that? Exactly. Because remember, J.B. Pritzker and a lot of other politicians right now, they're talking about criminal justice reform. Right now, the law, this was our deal of the day yesterday. This is our deal of the day yesterday. Somebody who broke into a pawn shop, took several hours to do so, stole 20 firearms, some of whom were recovered in the, or some of which were recovered in the possession of gang members, one of which was recovered at a crime scene. And this guy, who's a felon, by the way, already a convicted felon, gets less than 5 years behind bars. That's it. Less than 5 years. He got caught. Now, that's what the law is right now. So if we're going to try to eradicate the black market, I want to know some specifics here. How much time are we going to do? How many prosecutors are going to devote to this? because we're already seeing, again, 97% of felony cases plea bargained out. And it seems like a really big undertaking to claim that you're going to be able to eradicate the black market entirely, to make it illegal. There's just not going to be a black market. Yeah, I guess you'd throw all those people in prison. That's going to take a lot of prosecutors. Then what? You're going to expand the police force? Because, again, I think there's a lot of concern among maybe J.D. Pritchard. What's his name? Not J.B. Pritchard. J.B. Pritzker, excuse me. Probably a lot of his base not real happy with the idea of expanding the police force in Chicago or elsewhere. But I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think he's making one of those soundbite solutions where, you know what, if we just have enough gun control laws on the books, the black market will disappear entirely. If we just have enough gun laws on the books, all of which, by the way, are aimed at people who are right now legal gun owners, criminals are somehow going to change their behavior. Violent criminals are somehow going to be unable to find the guns that they can easily access on the black market right now. They're going to find a respect. More importantly, they're going to find a respect for life. They're going to figure out a way to talk through their differences. All it's going to take is just a few dozen gun control laws. That's it. It's absurd. Pritzker says we need to ban guns and magazines over 10 rounds. And we need to stop the importation of illegal guns across Illinois' borders. Apparently build a wall. It's also time, he says, to enforce universal background checks and enact a gun dealer licensing bill. Now, in Illinois, in order for you to legally purchase a firearm, you have to have what from a private seller or a FFL, doesn't matter. You have to have a firearms owner identification card, which requires you to undergo a background check. And every time you purchase a firearm, that status, that FOID card is checked. So you already, again, are carrying a card from the state of Illinois that says you're a legal, lawful gun owner. Those FOID cards, actually, I think they run the FOID card checks every day, according to, I think, our friends with Illinois Carry. So you've already got that system in place, but apparently that's not enough. There has to be something more. There has to be that quote-unquote universal background check, which means that you want to loan your buddy a hunting rifle. I'll give you a perfect example. Kyle here in Farmville has one of my rifles right now. He's had it for several months. I did not go to an FFL to make that transfer because I know Kyle. I know Kyle's a lawful gun owner. I know I'm a lawful gun owner. I'm not going to go to an FFL, pay a fee to transfer a firearm when I'm going to get it back. But that's exactly what the law would require. It doesn't matter that I've worked with Kyle for years. It doesn't matter that I know that he's a legal gun owner. The law would require me, in order to not become a criminal, to go find an FFL who is willing to do these transfers, pay the fee, go back and do it all again when it's time to transfer that rifle back to me. Now, maybe a lot of legal law-abiding gun owners are going to do that. How many criminals do you think are going to do that? I'm guessing zero, too. But this is, again, the other big idea. And it doesn't matter that gun control advocates, like Aaron Wintemute at the University of California, Davis, they've conducted research showing you can pass these laws, you can put them on the books. Background checks don't really go up. And even when they do, it's weird. We saw the homicide rate go up, too. The background checks went up and the homicide rate went up. But again, this is a soundbite solution. This is what a politician says when they want to be able to say they're doing something. Not something that works, just something that'll give them a headline. Something that'll give them a press release. Something that'll give them a photo op. Not something that'll make the lives of Chicagoans any better. Arguably, will erode the rights of law-abiding residents across the state of Illinois. Pritzker goes on to say, restoring trust between law enforcement and the communities. So that was his gun control paragraph, by the way. That's as detailed as he got. goes on then to restoring trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve requires transparency and accountability in law enforcement, as well as training that includes de-escalation tactics and proper use of force. Community members must also feel safe coming forward to report crimes and testify. Again, just sort of an afterthought. Community members must also feel safe coming forward to report crimes and testify. Mostly it's going to be on the police. Why is it? Why is it that there's a reluctance to come forward to testify in a lot of these cases? Is it distrust of police? Maybe in some cases. Absolutely. Is it fear of retaliation? Yeah, absolutely. Again, not every case, but certainly in some cases. And then in some cases, there is that desire to not wait for the justice system to slowly grind its wheels to a resolution. And so you have these beefs that carry out across entire neighborhoods over weeks at a time. Each bit of retaliation leading to the next. That's one of the reasons why, again, there's a reluctance to go to the police. Snitches get stitches. The street code says you don't talk to the police. You keep this between groups of, or just between these individuals who are beefing. But there is also that fear of, if I call the police, I'm not a gang member. I have no problem talking to the police. Not sure what good it's going to do, but if I call the police and I report, you know what, I know who did that drive-by. And let's say they make an arrest, and that individual goes away. I also know, because I'm not stupid, that they're likely to be back out in a matter of hours, if not days. And while they're behind bars, their associates are going to be trying to figure out who actually talked to the cops. Now, can you keep me safe? Can you protect me? And the answer is no. Now, in Chicago, we've made some pretty good strides. But I would also argue that there is still, in the city, a cultural attitude fostered by the government that gun ownership is bad. Legal gun ownership is bad. Getting your concealed carry license is not a good idea. So on the one hand, you've got the government shaming those who would exercise their Second Amendment rights. On the other hand, those good people living in bad neighborhoods really do know that if they do want to try to clean up their neighborhoods, they better be really, really quiet about it. Hope nobody figures out it's them. Or they better be able to protect themselves. And I think that is an ongoing struggle. We've talked about this with Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Lives Matter, or Chicago Guns Matter. Master Ray's been out in Chicago this summer. But activists like that are not going to get the attention that an anti-gun activist in Chicago like Father Flager will get. Both trying to do the same thing, by the way. Both groups stated mission the same, to reduce violence, to improve the safety of these communities. And honestly, Chicago's tried to do it Father Flager's way for decades and decades, going back to the handgun ban of the 80s. They never really tried to do it Rhonda Ezell way. Never really tried to do it Master A's way, where you actually recognize that people have a right to keep and bear arms. You try to promote, heck, you try to establish a culture of responsible gun ownership rather than trying to fight the culture of lawful gun ownership. Chicago tried it Rhonda Ezell's way for a decade, tried it for, 10, 15 years, the way Master Ray or other pro-gun activists are talking about building that culture of responsible gun ownership in Chicago. Who knows what would happen? But you know, the politicians who are there right now would never let it happen. All right, I'm going to climb off my soapbox, and then we're going to take a break. And when I come back, Charles Cook from National Review is going to join us. We'll talk more about the truth about the Second Amendment. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Friday edition of Cam and Company.
Four liberals on the Supreme Court would take away your right to self-defense.
What does the Second Amendment mean to you?
It's not the right of an individual to keep a gun next to his bed.
Four liberal justices oppose your right to self-defense. Four justices support your right to self-defense. President Trump chose Brett Kavanaugh to break the tie. Your right to self-defense depends on this vote. Tell your senator, defend our right to self-defense. Confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
My daughter came into the bedroom and she said, Dad, there's a man in black tactical gear shooting up the Baptist church. Every one of those shots to me represented one of my neighbors, one of my friends. And I ran as fast as I could. Immediately, he came out of the church shooting at me. He hit the truck in front of me, hit the car behind me, hit the house behind me. And I hit him. He had an AR-15, but so did I. And it's not the gun, it's the heart. It's a matter of the heart. I'm not the bravest man in the world or anything, but I was here. I was here, and I could do something. And I had to do something.
All America lies at the end of the wilderness road. And our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild outside. We live in the civilization they created, but within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream.
This is where it all begins, at the Last Great Coliseum, the Bristol Motor Speedway, on August 18th, 2018. This is where the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race will be kicking off. Behind me and all around us, these stands are going to be filled with screaming, cheering race fans, NRA members, folks who love this country. And you've got to be a part of this. There's not a bad seat in the house at the Bristol Motor Speedway. It's one of the things I love about this place. First of all, look at the view beyond the track from up here, the mountains in the distance. And those hills right there closer to the track, they're going to be filled with folks who are camping, who've been here all week long as part of race week. And then, again, you can't get any higher than where we are right now at the Bristol Motor Speedway. But if you look down, it's like you are on top of this track. Imagine 40 cars, bumper to bumper, jostling for position right there. And it's like you're watching it from right on top of the action. Now, if you wait for this checkered flag to wave, you're going to be too late to get your tickets to the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. So you want to go ahead and you want to go to NRARaceTix.com now. You are going to get the lowest price for race tickets anywhere you can find it. 15% off for NRA members, any seat in the house, NRARaceTix.com. And when you get here to the Bristol Motor Speedway, there's all kinds of stuff to see and do, but make sure you actually come inside the Bruton Smith building. Make sure you shop here and get all of your cool merchandise for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. You've got stickers. You've got hats. You know I'm a big fan of hats, right? We've got koozies. We've got all kinds of great stuff. And really, the best thing that you're going to find here is the experience itself. There is nothing like the night race at the Last Great Coliseum. It's August 18th, 2018. We will see you in Bristol, baby, for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race.
Bristol Motor Speedway, the place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA. And take in the best bumper-banging, fist-waving, hero-making short track race of the year. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
To Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, still to come. Stephen Moore of the Heritage Foundation down at the American Legislative Exchange Council meeting in New Orleans. talking with our own Cameron Gray. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from National Review, here to talk about the entire Second Amendment issue, and more particularly his piece, The Truth About the Second Amendment. Mr. Charles Cook is with us. Charles, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Cam. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. And listen, not only thanks for coming on the show, but kudos to National Review for actually doing an entire issue devoted to the Second Amendment. And I want to ask, what was the reason for this? I mean, it's not like the Supreme Court has taken the Second Amendment case. It's been 8 years since we've had that. They haven't had any big legislation one way or the other passed through Congress. Why now a Second Amendment issue?
Well, from time to time, we do have issues that are focused on particular topics. We've had education most commonly. We have never done one that was solely on the Second Amendment, absent some provocation, maybe a Supreme Court case or, in much more depressing moments, some sort of abomination. And so we thought that these conversations are always best to have when people are not reacting to something. And it was worth putting together a number of different strands that we've been discussing and putting them in one place.
Well, again, it's a fantastic issue. And your piece in particular, The Truth About the Second Amendment, as you say, perhaps we have found some space to breathe and to think about these issues. We know the gun control activists, I really like that, Charles. I mean, they kind of rely on that emotional argument to win the day. And frankly, I mean, you bring a lot of facts to the table here, starting with just, you know, blowing up that canard that, the Second Amendment was never about an individual right to keep and bear arms. And even if it was, it would have been a right to carry muskets because that's all the founding fathers knew back then. But it really shouldn't even be an individual right. It was just the NRA that you know, started talking it up as an individual right. And then they bought off the politicians and the courts. And that's why we've got, you know, individual gun ownership today.
Yeah. One of the reasons that people believe that, I think, is that there was indeed a sea change in academic work and judicial attitudes between the 1960s, 70s, and the 1990s and 2000s, culminating in the Heller decision. That is true. And so when either people who haven't looked into it sufficiently or people who are simply lying make the case that there was a radical change in the interpretation and understanding of the Second Amendment between the mid part of the 20th century and Heller, they are correct. Unfortunately, what they always seem to miss out is that it was the middle part of the 20th century that contained the aberration, not the restoration in the 1990s, 2000s, and today. For almost all of American history, certainly for all of American colonial history, and then post-revolutionary history, the idea that the Second Amendment was not an individual right would have been laughed at, and you don't find it. You don't find it expounded by the people who wrote the Second Amendment and debated it. You don't find it being proposed at the state level. Remember, it's not just the federal government that has protection of the right to keep and bear arms. Mm-hmm. 44 states do. And many states did before the Second Amendment was written. You don't find it in any of the seminal legal textbooks of the era. You don't find it during the drafting and discussion of the 14th Amendment. You don't find it in the Supreme Court decision, Dred Scott, that prompted the 14th Amendment in part. And you don't find it in the academic literature in the second part of the 19th century. Where you do find it is among legislators and judges in Reconstruction era southern states who wish to prevent newly freed African Americans from carrying firearms. And then among the bigger government types in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and then among a lot of people who want to prevent crime in the mid-20th century. But this was an invention after the fact, and an invention that cannot be supported by our available evidence, which is what I wanted to point out.
Well, and again, I think you did a fantastic job of that. And you know, when you talk about that aberrational period, starting in the 1920s, And maybe carrying through the 1970s, right, is when you start talking about that pushback in academia coming from some interesting places. I mean, not necessarily coming from people on the right, right? I mean, you had guys like Lawrence Tribe talking about the individual right, Sanford Levinson writing about the embarrassing Second Amendment. Like it was this reluctance to actually finally acknowledge. That these words actually mean something, because I think the conventional wisdom had been at that point for 40 or 50 years, no, we can do whatever we want in the name of public safety. All the while, Charles, I mean, you're actually seeing some of the highest crime rates in American history, kicking up in the starting in the late 1960s, very violent 70s, dipping in the late 70s and early 80s, and then going up again during the crack wars of the late 80s and early 90s. And all the while, there's this attitude of, yeah, we just haven't found the right combination of gun control laws yet. When we figure it out, that's when the crime will drop.
Yes, and of course, you don't have to be in favor of private gun ownership to acknowledge obvious historical realities. And this is one of the reasons that I find this so appalling, is that it is a rewriting of history on a massive scale. One of the quotes that advocates of Second Amendment rights, such as myself, will often here being thrown at us is the one from Warren Berger, that the Second Amendment, as interpreted by the National Rifle Association, is a fraud. He uses that word. And people ask, well, how could somebody who was quite conservative and also so learned have got this wrong? But the answer is very simple. He got it wrong because almost everyone got it wrong. I mean, Lawrence Tribe got it wrong. He got it wrong in his 1978 great work. He got it wrong in the 1988 edition of the same book. And then in 2000, he eventually acknowledged that he'd got it wrong and that the Second Amendment did protect an individual right. I would recommend anybody read Sanford Levinson's Yale Law Journal paper, The Embarrassing Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. Now, Sanford Levinson is not one of us. He does not like guns. In fact, he says in the paper he'd be quite happy prohibiting them completely. But he doesn't just lay out exactly why the Second Amendment protects an individual right. It really is an excellent piece of work, but he also slams people on his own side of the political aisle for not taking it seriously, for being content to be ignorant, for letting their own political preferences color their conception of the law, color their understanding of history. It is quite easy to see, I will say, why people who don't know anything about it or who never looked into this, and Warren Berger was among them. He never saw a Second Amendment case. This wasn't something he ever studied. He was by no means a stupid man. But it's easy to see why people who haven't looked into it might fall into the trap of misunderstanding what the Second Amendment means. It is written in odd language for today. That's no excuse if you're studying it, of course, but it is for the layman written in odd language. And it's written in language that certain figures within the legal profession did anticipate might cause problems. One of them was Thomas Cooley, who wrote probably the greatest constitutional law book of the 19th century. And in 1880, he said, look, people are going to think that this is a right that is contingent upon militia service. And then he explains very, very, very clearly why that isn't the case. So I can see why people make the mistake. What I can't see and what I can't fathom is how people who look into this or who have claimed to look into it could possibly come away with another view. I mean, the fact that the American Bar Association in 1975 had as its official position that, and I quote, the Founding Fathers, it is doubtful that the Founding Fathers had any intent in mind with regard to the meaning of this amendment. The fact that that was their official position is a disgrace.
I mean, that's actually laughable. That is, we just threw it in there because we thought it sounded good. I mean, as you say, the historical record, you know, you look at the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution, and they talked about the right of the state, or the right of the people to keep their arms in defense of themselves in the state. And then a few years later, when more moderate lawmakers gained power in Pennsylvania and they revised the Constitution, they changed a lot of the wording. They kept that wording, Charles. That wasn't something that was so radical they felt like they had to throw out. That was actually something that was expressing the popular will of the people. I know that, you know, there's that argument of, well, it was just all because of the slave-owning states. But I know you and I have talked about this before. You look at New Hampshire. Their ratifying convention basically requested the Second Amendment. not because slavery was huge in New Hampshire, but because the right of the people to keep and bear arms was really important to those early Americans. And you're right. It's a, you know, we saw Michael Belial's book a few years ago, which actually was a work of historical fraud. But that fraud perpetrated on the Second Amendment extends far beyond one historian. As you say, this was the conventional wisdom, but it was all wrong.
That's absolutely correct. One of the things that you find in the embarrassing Second Amendment is a fascinating discussion of Republican theory. Republican, obviously, with a small r. The idea that some rights exist within the people, that the people is another unit within the vertical hierarchy of government, that you have the federal government and then the state. But you also have the people, and that the people exist separately. They don't have to channel everything they do through government. Government doesn't have to take over. It can be an auxiliary force, but it's not a replacement for people. And this sounds a bit odd to our ears at the moment for a couple of reasons. The first is we have outsourced so much to government. We have a police force that is supposed to be an auxiliary force, but which many, many people see as a replacement for individual self-defense and other things that we would have historically done ourselves.
And unfortunately, and the other reason, I'm sorry, Charles, I hate to do this to you, but we're coming up on a hard break, so we're going to have to leave it there. Sure. But listen, I would encourage folks, pick up the latest copy of National Review. This is a keeper if you're a Second Amendment advocate. And Charles, thanks so much for coming to the program, sir. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Charles Cook joining us from National Review here on Cam and Company. When we come back, Stephen Moore talking with our own Cameron Gray down at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company still to come.
It was a nightmare. That is one U-turn I wish I never made. It really changed my life dramatically.
No, he's not a criminal. He's a law-abiding citizen who our country asked to go fight two tours to Iraq. And he shouldn't be treated like a second-class citizen.
It felt like I was caught in a trap, just crossing the state line.
It's a trap. And next thing you know, he's in the nightmare. He's in the nightmare known as New Jersey gun laws.
It's been a while since I've seen my dad. So we made reservations at New Jersey Motorsports Park. It's a great experience. They teach you how to properly ride a motorcycle. So I was in my truck. I had my motorcycle in the back. Our hotel was on the racetrack, and I mistakenly passed an entrance. So no cars. It's 11:40 at night. I swing a U-turn safely, pull into the gate. It's locked. So I made a legal left and started going in the correct direction again. And the moment I did that, that's when the trooper sped up behind me and pulled me over. I just thought it was a routine traffic stop. He said, license and registration. I said, no problem. Now all hell broke loose after that. I opened my center console and it just happened so fast. Immediately, he was like, I see it, I see it, I see the gun. It was in the holster. He's like, put your hands on the dash. And that's when I told him I had my gun. I turn around and I have a pistol stuffed in my direction, pointing right at me, and it was an oh shit moment. That's when I told him I have a carrying license from the state of Pennsylvania.
Did he say to you at that point, do you know you're breaking New Jersey laws?
Yes, he said, I see you have a concealed carry permit, but that doesn't matter in the state of New Jersey. You're not allowed to have a firearm. This has no bearing on you having a firearm.
And you're thinking?
Wow, I'm in trouble. He walked right up to me, placed me under arrest.
Here we go again with New Jersey, where they are going after law-abiding citizens and turning them into criminals, destroy their lives for what is otherwise lawful possession of a firearm and the exercise of their constitutional right to keep and bear arms. It's disgusting.
It was very shocking. He's a law-abiding citizen with extensive training, and went through all the proper channels to retrieve his pistol. He went through a federal background check.
So I was sitting there in the cell, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm a criminal now.
In New Jersey, they have what's called pretrial, PTI. But you were turned down for that initially. Were you surprised?
very surprised because I met all the requirements.
He was absolutely the ideal candidate. Everything he did for his country, there was no violence, he was cooperative, no prior convictions for anything. PTI is that chance that you give when you make your one mistake.
But no, they were just going to play hardball. They denied me.
Did the prosecutor offer you a plea bargain of any type?
The plea was no jail time. You can walk away right now with a felony.
And you said?
No way. Just throw out the window my Second Amendment right. I'm not a criminal.
But then you got a call from the prosecutor, and he has a change of heart.
We had filed the appeal. We were going to go to court to fight to get him into PTI. And then you, Ginny Simone, you requested the court that you could film the proceedings on this case. The day it was approved, that day I got a call from the prosecutor saying, oh, we're reversing our position and we're going to put him in PTI. Really, the credit goes to you, to Ginny Simone and NRA News, because you pushed them over the top. Mainstream media won't follow this case. Thank God you did. All the charges are dismissed. There's no jail, no prison, so they don't lose their rights. This is why we need national reciprocity. The gun control laws create gun control victims.
They pass these laws in the name of injustice and a fake sense of safety.
No, putting me in jail, that's not going to reduce the crime rate.
It does not protect anyone. It ruins people's lives.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. I miss those piggies. I guess I should open the freezer and say hello at some point over the weekend. I'd like to dedicate that joke to the people of PETA. All right, now, coming up next hour, Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports, talking about the Bass Pro Shops Bristol Night Race. Right now, want to head down to New Orleans. Cameron Gray at the American Legislative Exchange Council, talking with Stephen Moore, economist at the Heritage Foundation. Take a look and a listen.
We are here in New Orleans, Louisiana, at the ALEC conference. Here is Stephen Moore of the Heritage Foundation. Stephen, it's good to see you, sir.
Cameron, great to be with you.
You're an informal advisor to the White House, of course. Stephen, I got it. It's amazing to me. When we watch, if the numbers that we have now were under the Obama administration, people would be the headlines would be unbelievable. Now it's never enough.
Doing cartwheels down Pennsylvania. 100%. Yeah, so yeah, we've seen almost a tripling of the growth rate.
It's unbelievable. Every article, it's so begrudging. No one can give the man credit. No one can give any.
You know, when the new numbers came out on the jobs last week, you know, they had to begrudgingly say, well, the economy's booming. And then, like on CNN and all these other shows, it said, like on the ticker, but economists say it won't last, you know. Right. Well, these are the same economists who said we weren't going to get here in the first place,
right.
And now they're saying it's not going to last. But, you know, I'm here to tell you I think it is going to last. I think we're going to see, you know, 2 or 3 years of this really strong growth as long as Trump continues to pursue the, you know, pro-free enterprise ideas that he's been promoting since the day he started running.
A lot of people, we're both in Washington. A lot of people hear a lot of the news and a lot of the words flying back and forth. Can you give us the elevator speech on tariffs? Just explain tariffs real quick, because it's a hard thing to understand, really. You know, are they good? Are they bad? How do you feel about that?
Well, tariffs are taxes, so I'm not in favor of tariffs in most cases. You know, Milton Friedman taught us all that, free trade, you know, if it's free trade, where two parties voluntarily are involved in a transaction, then by definition they're better off. Trump's view is a little bit different than mine on this. He believes that I used to challenge him in this, and he'd always say, "I believe in free trade, Steve, but it has to be fair trade. It has to be,
right.
You know, if we're going to cut our tariffs, they have to cut theirs." And I have to say, he has a point here. You know, we've cut our tariffs more than these other countries have, so we've opened up our markets. What about Japan? What about, you know, Germany? What about China? They haven't. What about Korea? They haven't opened up their markets to us. And so our producers face much higher tariffs when they try to sell stuff abroad than the Koreans do and the Chinese do and the Japanese do and the Germans do when they sell stuff to us. And Trump says that's not fair. We can't live with that. And so what he's doing is saying, I'm going to impose these punitive tariffs on some of these countries as a kind of stick to try to get them to lower their tariffs. Now, we'll see if that works. I think it may.
Talk about right now where we're in a place where the unemployment is at record low numbers. When you talk about black unemployment, unemployment for women, can those numbers sustain?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, first of all, the challenge now is finding enough workers to fill jobs, you know. So maybe I spoke too fast when I said we can keep this unemployment rate down. I mean, what a lot of people call full employment is 4 to 4.5% unemployment, and we got 3.8%. Yeah, so we're below.
Super full.
We're below full employment tax unemployment rate. But, you know, look, this is a good situation because it gives, you know, workers some bargaining power. Now, the whole point of our economic agenda is to help middle-class Americans. This has nothing to do with rich people. I like rich people. I want them to get rich. But we wanted to help the middle class. They're the ones that have been struggling for the last 15, 20 years. And now, you know, a middle-class manufacturing worker can say, well, if you're not going to pay me more, I'm going to go down the street and get a job there. And so we're starting to see wages bump up, which is exactly what we wanted.
Stephen, how much would you give to debate economics with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
You know, I've debated a lot of these liberal. I mean, Paul Krugman, I've debated Robert Reich, I've debated, you know, Austin Goolsbee. But, you know, she says I think she has an economics degree.
Right.
But I don't know where she got it, the University of Caracas, Venezuela. But, you know, she's a very charming person. She's very charismatic. It's just too bad she doesn't really understand some of these basic principles of economics, that private free enterprise is what creates growth. She wants more, you know, I heard her say she wants tax rates of 50, 60, 70%. Well, you're going to kill the golden goose that lays the golden eggs,
right.
You know. So why do you want to do that? And so I think she's misguided. I think that her idea of, you know, she says she wants 100% renewable energy. What, you're going to put 15 million Americans out of work that work in coal or, you know, the nuclear industry or our oil and gas? By the way, our oil and gas industry is booming like never before, and she wants to put a halt to that? I mean, a lot of it just doesn't make sense. I'd like to kind of try to teach her why she's wrong.
Yeah, good luck.
She's a young, you know, she's a young girl. She's, what, 28 years old.
Right.
But, you know, she's certainly dynamic. And, you know, it's too bad she doesn't really understand economics very well.
We talk real quick. You talked about the need for workers. Something that I see a lot, and a lot of your colleagues at the Heritage Foundation, and we talk about it on our show too, is the liberalization of college campuses. You can't be a conservative. You can't. Sometimes you can't be a Zionist. You can't be a Jew. I mean, there's a lot of. It's a very dangerous place for people on the right. And sometimes it seems to me, and we're also seeing these shortages of trades and really high-paying jobs that people don't think about. And I say to people, maybe start thinking about trade schools. I mean, the money is there, and obviously you're saying the need for the job, the need for the employees are there too.
I couldn't agree more with what you just said. You know, look, I have a liberal arts education. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, a lot of these kids are going to, you know, four-year colleges that cost $200,000 for 4 years, and they're coming out with a degree in political science or sociology or ethnic studies. And, frankly, there aren't a lot of jobs for people who with those degrees. You know, but if you get any kind of, you know, I'm a big fan of, you call them trade schools, junior colleges, apprentice programs. Trump has a great, you know, if you do an apprentice program and you become a carpenter or you become a mechanic, why shouldn't you have the equivalent of a college degree? We should give those people, it's probably worth more, right? It's probably worth more.
Financially, sure.
Yeah, and so, and you're learning something that's, you know, very, a skill that is so needed in this economy. So I'm very much in favor of that, of, you know, and that's my message to young people is, you know, get a skill. Because in this economy right now, if you know how to do anything, you can find a job in 24 hours. And by the way, if you just have basic skills, I mean, when I was in, you know, high school, they had shop class.
Right,
you know, you learned how to use some of this equipment. They don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so, but these businesses are so hungry for workers, they'll train them. So we just have to make sure that the kids are work ready, and a lot of them aren't.
Where are we right now in terms of credit card debt versus savings?
You know, the good news is income is up. So if people's incomes are up, they can sustain more debt, right? So I always say you can't just look at a person's debt unless you know how much money they have. You know, if you've got a $50,000 income, you know, $200,000 of debt is a lot of debt. If you have a $250,000, you know, income, you can sustain a $200,000 debt. So incomes are rising. And that allows people to borrow more. And by the way, it also depends on what people are borrowing for. If they're borrowing for a house or something like that, that could make sense. The only thing I object to, and, you know, here's my policy to avoid another financial crisis like we had in 2007, 2008, and 2009. You know, I'm old-fashioned. Let's just go back to 10, 15, 20% down payments on mortgages. If you had that policy in place, you would not have a financial crisis. You would not see people defaulting on loans because they have skin in the game. Right. The reason we had the financial crisis is the stupid federal government was providing people 100% guarantees on the loan repayments, and people were putting 3% down payments. So what happened is if the value of the house fell by 5 or 10%, all of a sudden they have negative equity. Right. They're better off walking out of the house than paying in the mortgage, and that's what people did. If you've got a 20% down payment, you're not going to you've got a stake in the game. You're not going to walk away from that house. So how's that for a housing strategy?
I'll take it. Who might argue with you? Yeah. You're Stephen Moore. Last question, sir. You know, you're talking about a robust economy that you think is going to grow and grow and grow. Give us a couple of your best tips for just say your average listener or viewer to the show right now for saving money, spending money wisely. What's the thing that you like to get across?
Number one tip, especially for young people watching this, if you're under the age of 30, but it also applies to, you know, people in their 40s or 50s. Start saving when you are young. You know, if you're 19 or 20 years old and maybe you got a job, you're getting $10 an hour, just take 10 or 15% of every dollar of that paycheck and save it and put it in the stock market. Don't touch it. You know, the most powerful force in the universe, according to Albert Einstein, is compound interest. And if you start saving at a young age, you're not going to need Social Security. You're not going to need Medicare. And by the way, for the young people out there, it's not going to be there for you anyway, so you better prepare for that. So save early. And, you know, people who save early, you know, you'll be a millionaire by the time you're 60 if you start saving when you're young.
What if you're older and it's never too late
for you?
It's over. Cut it. We're done.
No, I mean, look, I'm older, but you know, when you're older, you want to move out of stocks into bonds because you want safer investments because you're going to be spending down your savings. But also you want to save money for your children. You want to have an estate. So look, I'm very bullish on the stock market. I think America is always a great place to invest. And I'm a big believer that one of the most important financial reforms we could have in this country is to move toward allow young people, instead of sending, you know, 15% of their paycheck every month to the federal government in terms of Social Security, let them put, say, 10% of their paycheck into an individual retirement account like a 401k and build up their personal savings. And can you imagine how much richer people would be? You know, your kids and my kids, if they could do that. And then they wouldn't have to rely on Social Security because they'd have a big nest egg that they could depend on for their retirement. So that's something I'm really fighting for.
All right, last question. I don't know the first thing about Bitcoin, but I think if you're going to tell me, don't bother learning about it.
I don't know the first thing about Bitcoin either.
If you don't know about it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. You'd have to ask my colleague at the Heritage Foundation, who's an expert on this. But look, the dollar's strong. The U.S. Whenever the U.S. economy is strong, the dollar is strong. And so everybody wants to, the reason people are investing in the United States is everybody around the world is confident about our future. You know, and that happened under Reagan. Remember Reagan, everybody started investing here. And guess what? It's happening again now under Trump.
Steve Moore, it's an honor. Thank you for your time, sir.
Yeah, thanks to the NRA. You're a great, great, great pro-freedom organization.
There you go. Stephen Moore of the Heritage Foundation. Good advice, by the way, from Stephen Moore. Start saving early. As I was doing my research for our good guy of the day, which is coming up in hour three, ran across this story from the Kokomo Tribune. Doesn't really fit for our good guy story, but it's a great story. It is the story of young Leo Massey, who is 4 years old, and already has his own produce stand there in Kokomo, Indiana. Yeah, his mom, Meg, says he's always wanting to work. We literally have to make him go to bed, especially when the sun's out and we're all still out doing stuff. Like that, Leo was born to work. And so when Leo's parents moved to their land there in Kokomo, which is right next to, I guess, another set of parents, there was a small garden. Young Leo got attracted by the garden, said, we're gonna set this up. We're going to fix things up here. We're going to get some stuff going. Goes out with his grandmother. They start planting the garden. They have a little produce stand last year that Leo basically, he did, you know, the lion's share of the work. At that point, I think it would have been three. Raised $2,000 from that produce stand, every penny of it going to Leo's college fund. And this was just like at the end of their driveway. It was a little, you know, honor system roadside stand. Leo now has a better location on the main street in town, and I think Leo's going to be raking it in. So, you know, again, Leo's starting early. When I was four, I did not have a produce stand. I was not out there working. I was playing with my Star Wars action figures. That was basically my life, and I didn't get paid for it, unfortunately. But you know what? Leo's not going to saddle his parents with student loan debt, so Good on Leo, an inspiration to us all at the age of four.
4 years old.
Meg, his mom says, four. Yeah, he's four.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Meg said he really is working for it. She said, we thought that would be a better plan than just handing him a bunch of money when he turns 18 that he had nothing to do with. This way he learns along the way and takes pride in what he's done. What a novel idea. Teaching kids the value of work. It's crazy, but you know what? It just might be effective. Maybe we should more of us should adopt this policy. All right, coming up next hour, Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports talking about the upcoming Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. Also, we'll head back to New Orleans. Saul Anousis talking with Cameron Gray there at the American Legislative Exchange Council meetings. In hour three, Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, our good guy as well. Plus, Sean Maloney joins us from Buckeye Firearms. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. More of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. It is on the way after a quick timeout, so stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company is coming up next.
Speaking with Mark Bayless with the Valor Clinic. The Valor Clinic Foundation is the official name. And Mark, thank you for being here. Tell us, what is Valor Clinic? What do you do?
Thank you for having me, sir. We help struggling vets, usually with the War to Peace readjustment. Very often that includes the emotional scars of war, or PTS, as it's generally referred. And we've built a program for when PTS results in homelessness. We have a facility in Northeast Pennsylvania, where we restored an old historic hotel and made it into a bed and breakfast for homeless veterans. And we run a program that has a very, very good success rates for follow-on placement. And we've built a program to rebuild the life skills and focus in their life that the veterans need to help them manage the emotional scars of war and their day-to-day lives. That has proven remarkably effective. We have about 330 veterans through that program now, and they are all still alive, and we are very proud of that fact. And we are currently working to get some unity effort among other groups doing similar work, and we think there needs to be a rally cry like pink is for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And the color we are trying to make the rally cry, we're in the process of making. Let me keep it on a positive tone. We're in the process of making the rally cry to bring the other veterans groups together, and all agencies that are helping with this problem would be in the color match system, a color called Pantone 395, but we call the color Vet 22, and I'm wearing this tie and symbolism for that color today.
That's the color.
That's the color.
Very
nice.
We
tried to tie it to when you had to figure out, okay, what color do you use? America's very familiar with tie a yellow ribbon, right? Welcome home, the veterans.
Of course.
But we wanted some. We need some alarm to raise here too. The suicide rate at generally acknowledged as 22 a day. The number by study varies some. I've seen them as high as 28 estimates and as low as 20. But if you talk to veterans' families who have been fallen as casualties in the war at home, they argue that a lot of things aren't tracked. A lot of the veterans, when they take their own life, are doing it by intentional overdose, and then the statistic goes up. It was an overdose. It wasn't a suicide.
Right.
Or one vehicle accidents, and those go down as a motorcycle crash or a car crash.
Right. So.
And they don't go down as a suicide. So there are some that suggest the number is much higher, but if you use 22 a day, we've lost about 6,000 troops to armed conflict since 9/11, and in a similar time, do the math. 365 times 22 times, it's an alarming number. I believe it's in excess of 130,000 now as we roll. And it is a tragic epidemic, and it needs to be corrected. And I believe if all the people working on this problem don't come together somehow to show some unity effort, this problem will not be fixed. And so we call for other organizations or even businesses when they're doing their Veterans Day promotions and celebrations to acknowledge veterans. Maybe they do a hat tip to the war at home and maybe include some Pantone 395 in their color and in awareness for the veteran suicide problem. And we believe the veteran homeless problem largely comes from the PTS problem as well. But I will spare your audience too much detail on that.
Worthy of another interview. Speaking with Mark Bayless of the Valor Clinic Foundation. All right, Mark, before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Valor Clinic Foundation?
You can follow us on Facebook, keyword Valor Clinic, or you can go to our website at www.valorclinic.org. And we appreciate your time, taking time to listen and hear our message. And thank you very much for your support.
Thank you for what you do, sir, and keep up the good work. Stay in touch. We love what you're doing. Thank you.
Watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. Coming to you from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia. I will be making this drive about a week from today. Actually, exactly a week from today in a couple of hours. And I will be heading down to Bristol, Tennessee, and the Bristol Motor Speedway, and the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race, and it is August 18th, and you can get your tickets at NRARaceTix.com, and it is going to be incredible. I am so excited about this. John Popp's going to be there. Cameron Gray's going to be there. And there'll be, 100,000-plus other people there as well. And it won't just be like, us three and then you. Trust me, it's going to be packed. But it is such an amazing location. It is such an incredible race. Very, very exciting. And you've got, quite frankly, you've got a heck of a year shaping up right now. We are getting into the home stretch, getting ready for the playoffs. We'll talk about the latest with Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports as the drivers make their way to the final few races here in the regular season. Saul Anouz is talking with Cameron Gray down at the American Legislative Exchange Council as well, coming up later on this hour. And an hour from now, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day as well. In the more guns doesn't always equal more crime files, because the gun control advocates, their fundamental belief, more guns inevitably equals more crime, right? And so less guns and more gun control, less crime, right? Well, here in the United States, we've been confounding the gun control advocates for a couple of decades as gun ownership has increased. You've got millions of people who are concealed carry holders now. Number of privately owned firearms in this country, roughly 400 million in 2018. And from 1991 to 2015, violent crime dropped about in half from its highs in the early 1990s. Homicides dropped about half. Juvenile homicides dropped by two-thirds. Now, again, there was a uptick in 2015 and 2016, last year's of the Obama administration. We don't have the final numbers for 2017 yet, although I would expect we're probably going to get them in about a month or so, because what we've learned is that in Brazil, other countries are starting to release their 2017 statistics. And in Brazil, a country with a great amount of gun control, a very small amount of legal gun ownership, homicides soaring in that country. Less guns, more crime in Brazil. Number of homicides increased by 3% to a record high of 63,380 homicides, 880 homicides in Brazil in 2017. The average homicide rate for all of Brazil in 2017, 30.8 homicides per 100,000 people. 31 murders per 100,000 people. Here in the United States, our homicide rate is about 5.5 per 100,000 people. And again, that's down quite a bit from what it was in the early 1990s. But even back then, the national homicide rate would have been about one-third that of Brazil's. Now, in Brazil, as I mentioned, legal gun ownership is really rare. In fact, UPI, United Press International, reported that Brazilian police seized 119,484 firearms, 95% of which were not registered in the federal police system. So, again, you've got really restrictive gun control laws on the books in Brazil. In order for you to be a legal gun owner, you've got to get approval by the police. In order for you to carry You probably got to pay some folks off, but it's a even more lengthy and convoluted process. There is no right to keep and bear arms in the Brazilian Constitution. Despite the fact that there aren't a lot of legal gun owners, a few years ago when anti-gun activists put on the ballot in Brazil a nationwide referendum to ban handguns, that measure failed. And it failed by wide margins. Now, violent crime in Brazil, even back then, was still much higher than it is in the United States. But the people of Brazil, many of whom were not legal gun owners, many of whom never could have met the prerequisites to become legal gun owners, when given the option to ban gun ownership, said no. Now, it has been a struggle since then to actually get the right to keep and bear arms recognized in Brazil, so the average Brazilian can own a firearm for self-defense. Again, the gun control laws clearly aren't stopping the violent criminals from illegally obtaining firearms and using them in Brazil because they've got a record high number of homicides. And UPI, they spoke with just one police sergeant. So I won't say that the sergeant is going to be a representative of the entirety of law enforcement across Brazil, but I thought it was interesting that the sergeant didn't talk about the need for more gun control laws. Instead, Santa Catarina Police Sergeant Alessandro Lotin said, not enough murderers are imprisoned, and police focus on repressing criminals rather than preventing violent crimes. He says there is an impunity about homicide crimes in Brazil. Not enough murders are imprisoned. So if you actually got tough on the people committing the violent crimes, as opposed to continuing to crack down on people who would like to be legal gun owners, it sounds like that police sergeant saying you might see better results there in Brazil. Well, again, it is a grim milestone for the nation of Brazil. But another reminder, you know, when the gun control advocates say, well, why aren't we more like Australia? Why aren't we more like England? They never bring up the countries with really restrictive gun control laws and really high violent crime rates. I mean, Mexico is literally right across our border. You will never hear a gun control activist say, why are we more like Mexico? Why don't we have one gun store located in the middle of the country, like in Nebraska somewhere? And if we could just convert the Cabela's in Sydney to the one gun store in all of the United States. And if you want a firearm, you got to go to Sydney. And we're going to build a military base around it, because in Mexico, the one gun store is on an army base. So I guess we're going to have to build a military installation around the Cabela's there in Sydney. And once you're there, you can purchase a 22 caliber rifle. You could purchase a revolver up to 38 caliber. And that's it. That's it. That's what we should have here in the United States. We should have those style gun laws. Nope. I mean, you'll hear, you know, again, all kinds of talk about Australia's gun ban and England banning handguns, but they don't really want to talk about those nations that are, frankly, a lot closer to the United States than Australia, that have these really restrictive gun control policies in place and have violent crime rates that are shamefully high. They really don't want to have that discussion. We'll see, by the way, what this does. In Brazil, the release of this new statistic, because there have been moves over the past couple of years, again, to try to recognize the right and actual right of the people to keep and bear arms that would be codified into law, that would theoretically anyway make it a lot easier for the average Brazilian to be able to legally own a firearm. But obviously there's been a lot of opposition, and Brazil has had a great deal of political turmoil over the last few years, with one president getting impeached and a former president, I think, getting put in prison. And there's still been fallout over that. So a lot of the big legislative to-do items, even ones that I think are pretty popular, haven't really had a chance to get acted on there in Brazil. Meanwhile, here in the United States, a new study out from a University of North Texas professor, which is published in the new book, Compromising Scholarship, Political Bias in Higher Education, by George Yancey, found that members of the NRA are the most likely to be discriminated against if they apply for a job in academia. The most likely group that George Yancey measured. The NRA was number one. He said the goal of his research was to investigate possible hiring discrimination. And he said because finding clear incidents of this is difficult, he indirectly assessed this by asking professors their thoughts on certain political groups. His survey, taken by 435 sociology professors in the United States, asked, assume that your faculty is hiring a new professor. If you were able to learn of their political group memberships, would that make you more or less likely to support their hire? Political groups listed in the survey included Communist, Libertarian, Green Party, Republican, NRA, ACLU, Democrat, and George Yancey also included groups like vegetarian, single parents. He didn't want professors to be able to easily identify the fact that he was asking about political affiliations and how the professors thought about that. But of all the political affiliations, Yancey found NRA membership was ranked as the most likely to hurt an aspiring professor's chance of getting hired. 41.2% of those sociology professors who were surveyed said that it would damage an applicant's chance of getting hired. 42%. Republicans, 28%. Actually, 29% of professors said, yeah, if I knew they were Republican, I'd have issues with that. And that's bad. That's almost a third of the sociology professors surveyed. But more than 40% of these professors said, oh, if I knew they were an NRA member, I just don't think I could support that. I mean, look, we knew that academia, by and large, is very hostile to the Second Amendment. And it may very well be, look, yeah, this is Texas, and I know this was a nationwide survey of sociology professors, but the issue of campus carry has come up on more and more campuses over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, you know, we've seen a lot of these professors, I'm talking with Charles Cook about this last hour, rather than use campus carry as a an opportunity to actually educate themselves on the issue, these educators have instead decided to put feelings before facts. And you've actually got professors in Texas right now who are suing over the state's campus carry law. They're alleging that their First Amendment rights are being violated because speech is being chilled in their classrooms because there could be somebody who's legally carrying a concealed firearm. And because there could be somebody carrying a concealed firearm legally in the classroom, people are afraid to speak their mind. Now, this is a stupid argument, given that, again, concealed carry is the law in the state of Texas, and I guarantee anybody sitting in that college classroom, if they're on campus for any period of time, if they're outside of their room over the course of a day, if they're going to the grocery store, if they go out to eat, if they go to the mall, if they're driving on the road, guarantee you they're around concealed carry holders. Guarantee you. And they're not changing who they are. They're not, oh, I better not listen to my song this loud. There might be a concealed carry holder in the car next to me. They're not doing that. Why? Because concealed carry holders are safer than the general population, not only in the state of Texas, but around the country. They're not violent criminals. But this is the argument that these professors are making, because they are, I think, again, just so incensed in some cases by the idea of the right of self-defense applying to college students, even on a college campus. And, you know, I don't think they're thinking this through. I really don't. I mean, many of these college professors, I'm sure, believe that you don't have a right to keep and bear arms. I don't have a right. They don't have a right. It's not a right. Supreme Court got it wrong. I'm sure that's a very prevalent thought in academia. They're wrong, by the way. But your right to protect yourself, and it is a right, doesn't stop at your front door. Why would it? You know, we just had this decision out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Young case, dealing with the open carry in Hawaii. And Judge Gerbert O'Scanlan, writing for the Ninth Circuit, examined this question thoroughly. And he already said, you know, he said, look, my colleagues in the Ninth Circuit say we don't have a right to carry a concealed firearm that's protected by the Second Amendment, but we've got the right to bear arms. The Supreme Court's told us in Heller and McDonald that the core purpose of the Second Amendment is to protect the right of self-defense, to ensure that, that right of self-defense can be exercised. And we know that keeping arms is not the same as bearing arms. So if keeping arms is a real right, bearing arms is right there, has to be a real right too. And that means that there has to be some way for the average Hawaiian, the average Virginian, or the average Texan to be able to bear arms, lest their rights be violated. It's as simple as that. Unfortunately, try to explain that to the average sociology professor these days, apparently, or at least 4 in 10 of them, and you're likely to get your food spit in. You're surely not going to get hired. Yancey also found hunters, evangelicals, and fundamentalists also less likely to be hired. He says, my work here has moved me to thinking that anti-discrimination programs should focus on our national propensity to discrimination rather than focus on non-discrimination of protected classes. We all tend, he says, to have groups that we have prejudice towards. And he says, if you do want to get hired, if you're a professor and you're looking for a job, academia is tough these days, especially, you know, if you want a job with tenure. He said, aspiring professors who are members of the Democratic Party and the ACLU should trumpet those facts during the interviews. Those who are conservative, religious, and politically to the right should hide their views. And that, apparently, is what passes for academic freedom these days. All right, when we come back here on Cam and Company, Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports is going to join us later in the hour, heading down to New Orleans to the American Legislative Exchange Council. Stick around. There is much more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
Politicians are very good at playing with words. They always talk about gun control. How about right control? Because when you go against the Second Amendment, that's our right. That's our God-given right, not only by God, but by the Founding Fathers. So why don't you just call it what it really is, right control? You're taking our rights away. You cannot regulate evil. Evil is evil, and evil is always going to be persistent, and it's always going to be here. So why get rid of our ability to protect ourselves? The Second Amendment right protects the rest of them, and it protects us. It protects your home, your body, and your spirit, because without it, how are you going to protect yourself? Don't be a sheep. Don't follow just because it's popular. Think for yourself. Be yourself. Be that individual that God made you to be. You wasn't born to follow. You was born to lead.
The Bristol Motor Speedway holds all kinds of events all year round, including, as you can see behind me, monster trucks. But August 18th, it's the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. And over the next couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about the track, exploring the town of Bristol, and showing you why you need to be here in the stands for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. So we are about as high up as you can go here at the Bristol Motor Speedway right now. No more seats above us. And you can look down in the track, and you can see, even in the highest seats possible, the nosebleed section, this is an amazing view. And you've got the race that's going to unfold right before your very eyes. There's not a bad seat in the house here at the Bristol Motor Speedway. And even beyond the track, as the sun is setting on August 18th, you'll be able to look up. You'll be able to see those mountains off in the distance. The hills closer to the track will be filled with folks who have been camping out here all week, celebrating what makes America so great, celebrating the Bristol Night Race. I'm telling you, it is something that you actually have to see yourself to really understand what Bristol and the Night Race is all about. So I'm here in downtown Bristol, Virginia. I'm on the Virginia side. Right across the street from me is the state of Tennessee. This is a really unique location here in the United States. You've got this incredible border town, and the history of this, you know, it used to be back in the old days, you'd have the honky-tonks on the Tennessee side, you'd have the more staid establishments on the Virginia side. When they would shut down, everybody would go across the street, have a little bit more fun down the Tennessee side of town. Now, this is a pure slice of Americana right here. And I tell you what, you've got the historic buildings, you've got some incredibly old establishments, but you've also got new businesses that are opening up and reinvigorating the community. on what seems like a weekly basis here. Not far away from me, we're going to head there next, is the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. There's all kinds of things to see and do in the Bristol area, so don't just come down Saturday morning for the Bristol Night Race and think that you're going to come home Sunday morning. Spend a couple of days here. Soak in the atmosphere. It is a beautiful part of the country and a fantastic place to spend a summer weekend. So just off of State Street, actually, you'll find the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. Make sure you take a couple of hours while you're down here for the night race and explore this incredible facility. If you love country music, if you love American history, there is so much to learn here. It's all interactive. And the museum actually is pretty new, only opened a couple of years ago, and it is already a crown jewel here in the Bristol area. Now, you know you don't want to see me waving this tiny little checkered flag. You want to see the real deal here in Bristol, right? And you can do so. We've told you how. NRARaceTix.com, August 18th. You're going to get the best price for a seat in the house there. 15% off for NRA members anywhere you want to sit in the Bristol Motor Speedway, August 18th, 2018. And I want to thank everybody here at the Bristol Motor Speedway for once again opening up their doors and their hearts. They're so generous. They are so nice here. It's going to be an amazing weekend. You don't want to miss it. Heck, it's going to be an amazing week. Forget the weekend. They've got events happening in the Tri-Cities area starting on Monday of race week. So go ahead, call the boss. I'm going to be off that week. I'll see you the week after the night race. And we will see you in Bristol for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race, August 18th.
Bristol Motor Speedway. The place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA. And take in the best bumper, banging, fist waving, hero making short track race of the year. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's Night Race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race, it's Bristol, baby.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. You can probably go pretty fast on the Beltway outside of Washington, D.C., but I guarantee you can't go quite as fast as you can go at the Bristol Motor Speedway on that half-mile oval. John Pop is excited. He's got his Bristol hat on. And Hollywood Jeff Hammond, our friend from Fox Sports, is with us on the program. I believe Jeff, I think, has some of the special on as well. Is that a We Stand shirt?
We Stand.
Oh, look at that.
We Stand.
Love it.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I'm telling you right now, I think about what's going on, and it's crazy.
Well, it is. You know, preseason football is here, and with it comes the controversy over players standing, kneeling, raising their fists, staying in the locker room, going out. Yeah, I think the NFL's made it even worse, honestly, this year around Jeff. But I'll tell you what, in Bristol, Tennessee, the evening of August 18th, when that national anthem is playing, you're going to see the drivers there standing. You're going to see the crowd standing. You're going to see the mechanics and the pit crews and the broadcasters. They're all going to be standing for the national anthem. Not because somebody told us to, not because we're conformists, but because we love this country and we recognize what that anthem means. And we are, again, we're celebrating the fact that we are Americans. There's nothing wrong with celebrating living in the greatest nation on earth, man.
No, it's not. And I think that's the one thing I love about people who embrace not only the sport of NASCAR, but who embrace the NRA as a whole, because it's all about respect. It's all about the country and those who came before us. And it's the right thing to do. You stand up for the flag and the national anthem. You bow your head when we say the prayer. I mean, they go hand in hand, and it's just a respect of what this nation really is. And if you don't like the way the nation is at this moment, then you negotiate. You sit down, you discuss it. You don't incite riots. You don't disrespect people. You don't have to, you know, go beat on people because they disagree with your philosophy. You know, I'm not going to go out and get in a fight with somebody unless they spit in my face. Now, if they do that, game on. But as a whole, we should be able to sit down and settle our differences in a respectful manner. And that respect goes to what we're talking about right now. The NFL, all those players, you have a right to disagree. You have a right to want to get your point across. But The president has already said, look, my door is open. I am sure that every congressman, every senator up there will listen, but they seem like they'd rather get out there and make a spectacle of themselves and demean their sport and disrespect their sport while they're disrespecting our country. And honestly, as long as they do that, I will not watch NFL.
Talking again with Jeff Hammond of Fox Sports. I had my, and I didn't make any big statements or proclamations, but I guess it was the entirety of last season. I just decided I got better stuff to do on Sundays, you know, and I still kept up with college football. It got real tough in the playoffs, Jeff, being a New England Patriots fan. You know, there was part of me that was just, I can just take the regular season off, but I'm kind of with you, you know, and look, I love the First Amendment just that much. I love the Second Amendment. And that means that I love people being able to say things that I absolutely disagree with. But this is not a First Amendment issue. As we've been reminded many times over the past week or so, private companies have the ability to set their policies as they see fit. And we may like or dislike those policies, but private companies can set those policies themselves. Beyond that, though, you know, look, everything has become so politicized. Everything's political now. And it used to be that the weekends, they were a time to escape, right? You could escape the office politics. You could escape the political scene. You could lose yourself for a few hours on a fall afternoon or watching a race or watching a football game. And I think that we're losing those things. And I think that Americans, again, it's not that we don't care about these issues, but we don't. It's okay to have a place to get away for a few hours and just to soak in the excitement of a football game, a baseball game, or coming up August 18th, a NASCAR race.
The point that I feel like we don't want to lose sight of is those players are playing because we, the fans, are buying the tickets, spending the time, you know, helping pay for television rights so we can watch a game. It's our choice. It's like they want to emphasize the fact it's their choice to do this. And they should respect the fact that if we don't like what they're doing, then we don't have to support what they want to do to earn a living. So it's really one of those kind of moments, I think, to where we have to understand that there's a better way. I said it earlier, they have a right. But don't disrespect me by forcing me to have to see the way you're doing it. And I disagree with that because I think you're disrespecting our country. And I'm not trying to, you know, I guess you might say diminish what they feel is important, but I wish that they could find a better way rather than basically, as you've already said, taking away from what something I enjoy doing. It's my moment of relaxation and this is what I work for. And when I go, if I was going down to the Carolina Panthers, which is my team, you know, I'm glad you're a Patriot fan. But if I'm going to go watch the Carolina Panthers play and I know they're going to do that, then I'm not going to support them. I can't do that. It's not in me because I feel like I'm a loyal American. And that begins with the respect given to the flag and the national anthem.
Absolutely. And again, you know, that is going to be on full display at Michigan this weekend, but man, I mean, this is America's night race in Bristol, Tennessee, on August 18th. If you love this country, I guarantee you, you're going to get chills being there for the national anthem because I know I did last year. It was just amazing. I can't even really describe
it. Over 100,000 people, you know?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And the jets flying over, and the crowd singing the national anthem along with that children's choir, and it's, I mean, it gets to you. It truly does get to you, and that's, you know, look, all that, you're going to be an emotional wreck before the race even begins, Jeff. But you know, the good news is we're going to have a heck of a race, man. I mean, we've got some incredible stuff and big stuff going on in NASCAR right now, including, let's talk about Mr. Chase Elliott last weekend.
I think that right there should really get NASCAR fans that haven't bought their tickets for Bristol or for Michigan this weekend, that's going to get them in line to get it done, because there's a lot of people that were always Bill Elliott fans, which happened to be Chase's dad for many years ago. And for this young man, he is truly one of the more popular drivers that we have in our sport today. And I'm so happy for him that he was able to get that win. And the way he was able to come about it, here, it's a little bit eerie because his dad got his first win on a road course in Riverside, California many years ago. And for him to get the one at Watkins Glen, and make his career start to parallel his father. And I think the cool thing about it is he went 2 years driving a totally different number on that car than what he is right now. It was a 24 car. But now he's in the 9 car, and I think that's great. All these things going in hand, and I think the timing is perfect. I think it's going to work out really great for Michigan this weekend and for Bristol next weekend for the fans to flock out there and have an opportunity to come to such a great event there in Bristol, Tennessee, and see this young man hopefully, you know, go for another win. He runs well up there. And I'd like to point out, I've been doing a little bit of reading, and I went and looked at a couple of videotapes. All you Dale Earnhardt Jr. fans, which, you know, he'll be there broadcasting the race. He made the comment one time that this is the greatest victory in his career when he won at Bristol. And that's a guy now who has won a Daytona 500, but he said this here meant more to him. And I don't know if it's because the dominance that his father had there, the drivers that went at a place like Bristol, because it's a driver's racetrack. I mean, you got to have a race car that can abuse, that can take the abuse. But this is a place where, you know, you got to get up on that wheel and you got to go up out there and you got to beat and bang and outsmart and you got to, I mean, you got to dig deep to win at Bristol. This is not an easy place. It's always been very physically demanding, very mental and emotional. You got to control your emotions and you always got to have laser focus to get the job done there. And for him to say that, I think it puts it in a different perspective of how important winning at Bristol is. A guy like Kyle Busch, who won the spring race, he's won 7 times there. He is going to be one of the guys you're going to have to beat come next week. Kevin Harvick, Kyle Larson, if you're a Kyle Larson fan, he's come so close to this racetrack so many times, and he wants to win so bad. And I think the fact he owes Kyle Busch a bump and run from the spring. So here we go again, coming back to what makes Bristol even more special. The patented bump and run has been around since they opened this place in 1961. So you think it's going to be any different next weekend? No chance. And we're getting so close to that cutoff of making the playoffs. Guys have got to win. Guys have got to have good finishes. It's going to be a lot of pressure for the young drivers and even more pressure on some of the guys who haven't got a win that need to get a win to lock themselves in.
Absolutely. Talking again with a friend, Jeff Hammond from Fox Sports, about the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. August 18th, you can get your tickets at NRARaceTix.com. 15% off any ticket for NRA members. So they've got all kinds of packages there at the Bristol Motor Speedway. I've been telling the viewers and the listeners, Jeff, about, you know, and I guess this is not uncommon for NASCAR tracks now, but you want to get that. We live in this individualized world, right? I can put my playlist of songs together. I can listen to everything that I want to listen to and no, you know, fills or filler on the way down to Bristol. And they want to provide that same sort of experience. You get exactly what it is that you want. So they've got all kinds of packages with all kinds of different levels of access to different areas of the track. And so, again, any one of those tickets, you're going to get 15% off. But it's really cool, actually, to see that personalization of the race experience from the fans' perspective.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Let's not forget Martin Truex Jr., Kevin Harvick, Ryan Newman, Clint Bowyer, to just name a few, Austin Dillon, I think Ty Dillon's also. They're going to be out. They're going to be available signing autographs. All you have to do is go on to NASCAR.com and look. I think it's on called Catch Fence. It will tell you about some of the things they got going on up there that are back out in the midway that Bass Pro, Cabela's, NRA have done for the fans, so they have an opportunity to bring their families up there and make this an all-day experience as we get ready to head into the night race. I mean, it's going to be basically the 12 hours of Bristol, because the race will start and it'll go to about midnight, but you can get there about lunchtime and have an opportunity to visit and get autographs from these drivers or go to one of these events in the midway. I understand they're going to have like a fish tank. I think you can do some fishing. You're going to be able to see turtles and different things like that they got on display. There's going to be a multitude of opportunities from, I guess, the Big Buck trailer will be there. I don't know how many different opportunities there'll be there for the different families, for the families to go find. But get online and check it out and see if there's something there. You want to make sure you maybe get there a few minutes early, get you a good parking place, and enjoy the afternoon leading into the event. And you already touched on the pre-race stuff. We kind of give you an overview about the race itself, but it is well worth the drive to Bristol or the ticket to get an airplane flight into the Tri-Cities or wherever your favorite airport is close by. But get there and be a part of it, because it will make it'll make it a destination for the rest of your life if you've never been there. And the folks that have been coming pretty much all their lives, they will echo the same sentiment once you meet them, because you're going to get an opportunity to make friends up there and realize you're not by yourself.
Absolutely. And looking forward to seeing you, my friend. Enjoy the weekend, and we will see you in Bristol here before long.
Yep, I'll be up there on Wednesday, and hopefully I'll get a chance to sign a few autographs and hang out with the fans. But I'm going to be doing an event with the Speedway Children's Charity on Wednesday afternoon. We're going to do a little skeet shooting at one of the local events down in Piney Flats. So if you happen to be in that area, stop by, and we'll talk about whether I got my eye that day, you might say, working like it needs to. But we'll talk racing. We'll talk whatever you want to talk about. We'll be there starting Wednesday. We'll be in the area and be enjoying the next 3 or 4 days with race fans and outdoorsmen and outdoor ladies who want to talk about conservation and hunting.
That is beautiful. Jeff Hammond joining us here on Cam and Company. Make sure you're following him on Twitter at Hollywood Jeff. When we come back, back down to the American Legislative Exchange Council, Solid News is talking with our own Cameron Gray. We will return with more Cam and Company right after this.
It was a nightmare. That is one U-turn I wish I never made. It really changed my life dramatically.
No, he's not a criminal. He's a law-abiding citizen who our country asked to go fight two tours to Iraq. And he shouldn't be treated like a second-class citizen.
It felt like I was caught in a trap, just crossing the state line.
It's a trap. And next thing you know, he's in the nightmare. He's in the nightmare known as New Jersey gun laws.
It's been a while since I seen my dad. So we made reservations at New Jersey Motorsports Park. It's a great experience. They teach you how to properly ride a motorcycle. So I was in my truck. I had my motorcycle in the back. Our hotel was on the racetrack, and I mistakenly passed an entrance. So no cars. It's 11:40 at night. I swing a U-turn safely, pull into the gate. It's locked. So I made a legal left and started going in the correct direction again. And the moment I did that, that's when the trooper sped up behind me and pulled me over. I just thought it was a routine traffic stop. He said, license and registration. I said, no problem. Now all hell broke loose after that. I opened my center console, and it just happened so fast. Immediately, he was like, I see it, I see it, I see the gun. It was in the holster. He's like, put your hands on the dash. And that's when I told him I had my gun. I turn around, and I have a pistol stuffed in my direction, pointing right at me, and it was an oh shit moment. That's when I told him I have a carrying license from the state of Pennsylvania.
Did he say to you at that point, do you know you're breaking New Jersey laws?
Yes, he said, I see you have a concealed carry permit, but that doesn't matter in the state of New Jersey. You're not allowed to have a firearm. This has no bearing on you having a firearm.
And you're thinking?
Wow, I'm in trouble. He walked right up to me, placed me under arrest.
Here we go again with New Jersey, where they are going after law-abiding citizens and turning them into criminals, destroy their lives for what is otherwise lawful possession of a firearm and the exercise of their constitutional right to keep and bear arms. It's disgusting.
It was very shocking. He's a law-abiding citizen with extensive training, and went through all the proper channels to retrieve his pistol. He went through a federal background check.
So I was sitting there in the cell, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm a criminal now.
In New Jersey, they have what's called pretrial, PTI. But you were turned down for that initially. Were you surprised?
Very surprised, because I met all the requirements.
He was absolutely the ideal candidate. Everything he did for his country, there was no violence. He was cooperative. no prior convictions for anything. PTI is that chance that you give when you make your one mistake.
But no, they were just going to play hardball. They denied me.
Did the prosecutor offer you a plea bargain of any type?
The plea was no jail time. You can walk away right now with a felony.
And you said?
No way. Just throw out the window my Second Amendment right. I'm not a criminal.
But then you got a call from the prosecutor, and he has a change of heart.
We had filed the appeal. We were going to go to court to fight to get him into PTI. And then you, Ginny Simone, you requested the court that you could film the proceedings on this case. The day it was approved, that day I got a call from the prosecutor saying, oh, we're reversing our position and we're going to put him in PTI. Really, the credit goes to you, to Ginny Simone and NRA News, because you pushed them over the top. Mainstream media won't follow this case, but thank God you did. All the charges are dismissed. There's no jail, no prison, so they don't lose their rights. This is why we need national reciprocity. The gun control laws create gun control victims.
They pass these laws in the name of injustice and a fake sense of safety.
No, putting me in jail, that's not going to reduce the crime rate.
It does not protect anyone. It ruins people's lives.
Welcome back to Cam and Comedy, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Cam Edwards, your host. Still to come on the program, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well. That's top of hour three. Also, Sean Malone with Buckeye Farms, Tony Katz as well. Right now, though, let's head back to New Orleans, the American Legislative Exchange Council meetings. Cameron Gray had the opportunity to speak with Saul Anouzis from 60 Plus. Take a look and a listen.
We're here at the ALEC Convention in New Orleans with our old friend Saul Anouzis. Now, Saul, you have a million titles, but you're also on the NRA Board's Public Affairs Committee. You've got a lot going on. Talk about your work with the NRA Public Affairs Committee.
So I've been privileged enough for the last six presidents have appointed me on the board to sit on the committees. As you're aware, we elect like 68 of our board members, and then there's 6 to 8 of us who are appointed by the current president to serve on various boards. So the last, I believe, six presidents have now appointed and reappointed me to sit on the Public Affairs Committee. And, you know, I've been a longtime NRA lifetime member and activist, and so I'm, you know, very proud and privileged to be able to serve on the board.
Well, it's good to see you. Good to have you talking about that. Okay, so we're in front of the booth here, National Popular Vote. That's one of the first things we'll talk about that you're involved with. Talk about that because, you know, we have the Electoral College. Right. We of course, see the left saying Hillary Clinton won, et cetera, et cetera. Give us the 30-second, give us the elevator speech on popular vote.
Yeah, so the elevator speech is very simple. We keep the Electoral College, but rather than using the statewide results on the winner-take-all, we use a national popular vote. So I agree with President Trump on this. Newt Gingrich agrees with us on this, is that if every American in every state vote counted in every election, it would make a difference, right? So take a look at the NRA as an example. We have 52 million Second Amendment supporters in this country. On any given election year, we turn out 25 to 35 million based on the targeted seats, the targeted states, and who's up running for president, where the battleground states are. If we had a national popular vote, it would be in our best interest to turn out all 52 million Second Amendment supporters, right? And we could make a difference in presidential elections. I think we're a center-right nation. I think more people share our values than theirs. So for me, I would like to have a national popular vote rather than having states like Florida and Ohio have a disproportionate amount of influence rather than having, you know, all 50 states have equal influence with regards to voters. So a voter in Ohio would be as relevant as a voter in Rhode Island or California.
People want to find out more. Obviously, it's a huge topic. It's lots of debates about it. Where should people go to learn more about that?
So just go to nationalpopularvote.com, and there's all kinds of information up there and questions and answers. There's we call it a myth section. It's chapter 9 in our book, and it really talks about what did the founders say, what's the constitutional background, what's the historical background to it. And it is a fascinating subject conservatives ought to take a look at.
Right, well, as if you don't have enough to do, you're also the president of 60 Plus.
I am.
Talk about that organization. Obviously, AARP has been the dominant force in that space for a long time now, but there's a need for conservatives to have their own organization that do similar things to AARP.
Absolutely. So 60 Plus, which is the American Association of Senior Citizens, was founded 26 years ago by a Marine named Jim Martin. Jim is still the chairman. I took over as president this year, and next year I'll take over as president and CEO of the organization. And we are the conservative alternative to AARP. We get involved in public policy perspective issues in Washington and in states, but we take a conservative perspective. So we back a free market. We want things done in a conservative way. We back conservative values. Obviously, we are unabashedly pro-life, pro-gun, basically most of the conservative issues that are out there. And so we're looking at trying to set up an organization that actually competes politically with them in Washington and elsewhere. And we're starting for the first time here, Labor Day, we're going to be launching a new website that actually has affinity marketing stuff where we'll have the same kind of discounts right. You can get at AARP, everything else. If you're a conservative, if you're a Republican, come to 60plus.org and you can take a look at it there and get some of the same deals or better deals and support a conservative organization rather than one of the most liberal ones in the country.
How much of a hit did they take when their vocal support of Obamacare and other things like that?
I think they took a big hit. Look, but there was no alternative, right? So what happens is that you're kind of you go there on a natural basis. I'm an AARP member because of the discounts. It makes sense. It's a cheap way to save money on car rentals, on hotels, and all that kind of stuff. Now we're going to have a conservative alternative, and I think that makes a big difference. And, you know, AARP makes, I think, like $600 million a year on selling insurance. I mean, it's really an insurance company more than it is an association, but then they take very liberal positions. So we need somebody on the right to challenge that, to be able to make a difference in Congress and in a lot of state capitals, and that's what we're starting to do.
So you're an old hand at Republican politics. You've been in the back rooms, the deals, the you've seen how the sausage has been made for a long time now. Talk about November. How do you feel?
Well, look, I think it's going to be a matter of turnout. I think that both sides have been pretty much identified. I mean, you're either for Trump or against Trump. You're for the Republicans, against the Republicans. The difference is that our side is satisfied. We think the Supreme Court justice appointments were critical. The Circuit Court appointments have been fantastic. You couldn't ask for a better president with regards to judicial appointments. If you take a look at our issues on the NRA, as an example, the president's been fantastic. If you take a look at the tax cuts and the things the Republicans have done, everybody's happy on our side. Happiness doesn't motivate people to vote.
Right.
What motivates
really
people to vote is the ones who are pissed off, right? So the left is mad. So, you can take a look at, like, Ed Gillespie's race in Virginia. I mean, he turned out about 125% of the Republican vote, got more votes than any Republican's ever gotten for governor, and lost because the Democrats turned out about 180% of their vote, right? Their people are motivated. So as an NRA member, as a conservative across the country, we've got to remember to go out and vote. I think what's going to be the determinant factor is turnout. If Republicans turn out and vote and make sure that they elect people who are going to support the president, the president's agenda. Look, even if you don't like the president personally, if you don't like his style, look at his policies. It's hard to find fault with most of his policies. And in order for him to have those implemented across the country, we need our voters to turn out. So I think November is going to be purely a function of turnout. If our voters show up to the polls, I think we're going to have a good election. If our voters stay home or just casually vote and the Democrats and the liberals and the progressives and the crazies on their side come out and do what they're doing, they're going to knock out enough of our guys that we could be spending the next 2 years dealing with impeachment,
right.
Stopping all our judges, all that kind of stuff. I mean, this is a very important election for us. And I think that people just have to be, cognizant of the fact that their vote matters. We have... the Democrats have to win 23 seats. I think you could take a look and very easily count 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 that the Democrats win. Hard to get to 23, especially if our voters get out. On the Senate side, we actually have pickup opportunities. So if you take a look at Montana, you take a look at Virginia, you take a look at Missouri, you take a look at North Dakota, take a look at Indiana. In those states in particular, there's 5, 6, 7 states. I guarantee you the NRA is going to play big in those states. We'll be involved there. Those are the places we've got to turn out and vote because we can make a difference. And that would make a huge difference for the president's agenda. It will also defend our Second Amendment rights, make sure we get good judges in the future.
When you see someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is the left, love the media, they can't get enough of her, the talk shows.
You guys ought to put her on.
She's a great spokesman for our side.
Right.
Do you think she's a problem or just a novelty?
I think she's a novelty, but a great opportunity for us. I mean, she's exposing what the Democrats really stand for. I mean, you've got Bernie Sanders and her going out talking about pure socialism. I mean, remember, government cannot give anything to anybody until it first takes it away from somebody else. Right? So we're trying to protect and defend the taxpayers' agenda, the ones who pay the bill. Those of us who go out and work for a living day in and day out, pay our taxes. I mean, if you take a look at their Medicare for All proposal, if you doubled the corporate tax rate for every corporation that pays taxes today and doubled every American's tax rate, you still wouldn't pay for that program alone, let alone get rid of the $19 trillion Obama deficit. So it is an unbelievably expensive program. It is unrealistic. But, you know, their political philosophy is fairly simple. If you rob Peter to pay Paul, you can count on Paul's support. Okay, those of us who work for a living and pay taxes, we're the Peters of the world, and their voters are coming in as Pauls who are trying to get a freebie. And it, eventually, you know, you and I may not pay, but our children and grandchildren get stuck with this bill. And that's a horrible way to run a government.
So as we wrap it up here, you're talking, and there's a lot of viewers and listeners in the NRA passionate about the Second Amendment. You know, talk about it again. You know, if the House goes over to the Democrats, the Second Amendment, you know, there's going to be a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. Look, there is no more important thing we can do as NRA members and as supporters of the Second Amendment is to get out and vote this time around. There are at least 30 to 45 congressional districts that are competitive districts that the Democrats have to go after. They need to win 23, and they've got a competitive advantage in probably 9 to 13 of them. On the Senate side, again, if you live in Indiana, Missouri, North Dakota, Montana, Virginia, you know, and Florida, and then you got states like Michigan that are long shots and a couple others that give us opportunities. I mean, if we could pick up some of those Senate seats, make a night and day difference for our agenda in protecting the Second Amendment and also in making sure that the president has people in there to support us with judges, with policies that make a difference for all Americans.
You talk about the states, talk about Indiana, talk about Alaska, talk about West Virginia, just in terms of Judge Kavanaugh.
Absolutely.
The need for those people to get in contact with their senators and have Judge Kavanaugh confirm.
I think it doesn't matter what state you live in. Everybody should call their senator and tell them the president, A, deserves the right to appoint his Supreme Court justice. Elections have consequences. Remember, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed with like 92 votes. I mean, Republicans and Democrats voted. You know, the president won. It was his appointment. Out of a courtesy, especially in the beginning of the presidential years, that's the way it worked, right? They have these. Right now, the Democrats are playing politics. They're trying to stir up their base. We have to be careful. We have to let them know that we're paying attention, that whether you have a Democrat senator or a Republican senator, you should call and say, look, the president deserves his nominee. We encourage you to support the nominee. And, you know, when they say, well, they were held up by, you know, the last nominee was held up in an election year. I mean, when Trump is up in his, you know, last 6 months, okay, now it makes sense to politically oppose him. But this man is in his second year of his presidency, making a very important appointment. The Democrats are holding up hundreds of judges, literally hundreds of judges, and the idea that we're going to let him get away with this in Kavanaugh is crazy. So call your U.S. senator, encourage him to support the nomination. Again, we've got somebody who supports the Second Amendment, someone who would support our position. I think it's a very important thing. But most important, make sure you vote in November. You got to get out there and vote in November.
So I know you're very busy online with social media and your emails. How do people get in touch with you?
So if you go to Sauls News, so SaulsNews.com, I post conservative articles every day. I've got a newsletter that goes out every Sunday. There you can sign up for it, basically sharing conservative views and what's happening in the country. And you know, you can find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm as you said, I'm very active on social media. I respond. You can even call me, and I'll give you a call back. But and soon you'll be seeing us on 60plus.org, which will be my primary place that I start playing here in the next 6 months or so.
Good deal. Thanks for your time, Saul.
Yeah, great to be with you, Cameron.
All right, we are going to, next hour, speak with Sean Maloney from Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well, about what's going on in Chesapeake, Ohio, where the fire chief has resigned now after the city council told firefighters you cannot carry firearms with you when you're on duty. It's going to cost too much money for us to insure you. It's going to cost $2,500 for us to insure every one of you firefighters. Not $2,500 apiece, just $2,500 to insure the fire department. As the fire chief said, look, you guys can't insure my safety because a lot of times I'm rolling up on calls and we're getting there before the cops arrive. And, you know, there are times we don't know how the people that we're going to be dealing with are going to react. They can react violently. And so if you're telling me that I got to put my life, I'm already putting my life in danger in terms of, you know, going and fighting fires, but you're telling me I got to take this extra step. What you're telling me is that I can't have a tool that I feel like I need for my job. It's like asking me to go inside that burning home without a mask on. And so I'm stepping down. The assistant chief, who's now the interim chief, says he and the firefighters will comply with the Towns demand, but they are hoping that the town changes its mind. We'll talk about this again with Sean Maloney next hour. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, will join us on the program next hour as well. Plus, we have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. I just saw this, friends at IWF just sent this to me on Twitter, a viral pro-vegan video surfacing on Facebook last week claiming that signing your children up for 4-H is child abuse. Vegan News is a popular vegan website that claims that they are fighting the largest Holocaust in history against the meat-eating population. Brandon Kirkwood is the founder of Vegan News. He's the creator of this video, calls 4-H a terrorist organization. 4-H. A terrorist organization, goes on to explain all the terrible things your child will be subjected to if, in fact, they join 4-H. She says, basically, learning to raise a farm animal and then selling that farm animal constitutes child abuse. That's his argument. He said 4-H brainwashes children into losing their compassion for animals and said that the children will probably not be vegan after their session ends. You know, so first of all, I got to say, I think it does the opposite. I think 4-H actually encourages compassion for animals. I think hunting does too, though, and I'm sure Brandon would disagree with me about that. I think one of the things that makes you less compassionate about animals is thinking that your food just comes from the store. I think actually knowing, okay, you know, that hamburger that I had for dinner last night, it used to be a cow. I think that actually makes you think more about how we care for those animals, not less. But what do I know? I'm not an angry vegan. Just somebody who's raised his own bacon and chicken and things of that nature. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, is coming up right after this.
Sheila Brantley. She is the program director of the NRA's National School Shield Program. Welcome to the program, Sheila, and tell folks, what is the NRA's National School Shield Program?
Yes, thank you so much for having me, John. I have the distinct pleasure of being the program director of the NRA's National School Shield Program, and we are all about looking at how to make our schools more secure. It's very timely of a topic. I think it's one of the newest programs of the NRA, and focusing on community safety, which we are founded on education, training, and safety since 1871. It's a natural fit for the organization.
So as you said, this is a very timely topic. A lot of happening that has people thinking about that, of the safety of schools especially. I mean, our children are the most precious resource we have, mm-hmm. so we want to protect them. So how did this all come about? How did it start?
Absolutely. Great question. So in December of 2012, we all know of the tragedy that struck at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And at that time, the NRA was thrust into the national conversation. And rather than pointing blame, we said, this is certainly an issue, and we have multiple resources across the nation also interested in looking at what to do to make our children more secure in their learning environment. We had a task force that we had appointed. Asa Hutchinson, now governor of Arkansas, had led that task force effort, and in April of 2013 published a task force report documenting a clear need to address violence in our schools and recommendations on best practices in school security. And from that point forward, we've continued to develop resources to protect our nation's schools.
Speaking with Sheila Brantley, she is the NRA's National School Shield Program, the director of that program. So Sheila, tell us, how does the program work?
Yeah, it's a great question. We are currently focusing, a cornerstone of the program is all about vulnerability assessments. You would not believe how many locations in the United States have no idea if they've conducted a vulnerability assessment. It's very hard to determine what your security posture is and where your potential vulnerabilities are. Have you not completed that assessment? So the NRA actually put the resources together, put this curriculum together, and it trains you how to conduct a standardized vulnerability assessment. You work from the outside perimeter all the way to the inside of the school looking at policies and procedures, and you're looking for not just those best practices in place so you can continue doing what you're doing well, but also looking for those vulnerabilities and saying maybe these are some areas that we might need improvement on. Could be visitor management, access control. You're looking for those multiple redundant layers of protection.
So I'm going to tell somebody this is the NRA's National School Shield Program. They're going to go, why do I want the NRA in my school? They're just going to want to arm all the teachers. So how does the program actually work?
It's
much more than that, right?
It's quite a myth about that. We are the NRA. I think what you need to focus on is we are empowering communities to be secure. And that's a natural fit for us as well. We come into the communities, there are no preconceived notions. We just know that it's a human right to want to be safe. And those children deserve a safe place to learn. And for our resources to come in, it's a lot of times current and former law enforcement officers that are training this program. And I would say if they are trusted to keep our communities safe, they certainly know what they're doing in the schools as well.
And there's so many facets, Sheila, between not just the firearm issue. There's security in the classrooms. There's access. There's eyes on everything. It's such a multi-layered approach. Right. And in the School Shield program, they address all those.
Right, you're absolutely right. We look at policies, procedure, infrastructure, technology, and personnel. It really is that multifaceted approach.
All right, so how do we get more information if someone's interested and wants to talk to someone about this program? What do you do?
Please visit us at nationalschoolshield.org. We have contact information there and a brief introduction to what the program is, more information about our training. We have grant funding, lots of information.
Watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. On the program this hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well, Sean Maloney from Buckeye Firearms Association, going to join us on the program. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, will be with us as well. I've got Cameron Gray tweeting me meat pictures from New Orleans at Koshan Butcher. Tagline, we love bacon more than you. Nuh-uh. Guarantee that's not the case. Thank you, by the way, Cameron, for tweeting me bacon pictures during the show. That's It's very kind of you. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, our good guy as well. Hero of the day from CBS in Pittsburgh. Pizza delivery driver shoots and kills attacker in Beaver Falls. This is in Beaver County. As a Domino's driver, it was early Friday morning, just after midnight. Amanda Blackwell, who lives in the area, said she heard commotion outside of an apartment on 2nd Avenue in Beaver Falls. She said, I heard the gunshot from my bedroom. I came downstairs and I watched him call 911. I went over and I asked him, meaning the driver, if he was okay. He told me he didn't know, and he told me to go back in the house until the cops came. Elise Clark was in the apartment that the pizza was delivered to. Clark said it was my boyfriend's roommate who ordered the pizza, and she just went up there, gave him money, and everything seemed fine. When the guy tried to go back to his car, apparently that's when he was robbed. Man in his late 30s tried to rob him, ended up stabbing the pizza delivery driver. Beaver Falls Police Chief John DeLuca said, as of now, we've confirmed that the actual ordering of the pizza is not connected to the actual robbery. A lot of times that happens. You know, drivers get a call for a delivery, they show up, and either the address is a vacant home or the people inside didn't order a pizza, and as the driver's walking up to the door, the driver gets ambushed by robbers. Police don't believe that was the case. Was this a crime of opportunity? Was this just somebody walking by who happened to see the driver there and thought, I got a knife, he's got some cash. Seems like these two things might be able to work themselves out. Police believe the delivery driver managed to grab a gun that he had in his vehicle and shot the suspect. After the attacker was shot, he ran almost a block down the street, collapsed on the steps of someone's front porch, where he died. Tony Pope lives nearby. Said he saw the man pass out on the steps. He said it was crazy. Tony Johnson, who lives there in the area, says the street's never been like this. I've lived here for 5 years. This is the first time this craziness has happened. CBS in Pittsburgh says the delivery driver was taken to the hospital, but there's no word on his condition. Unclear, CBS Pittsburgh says, if the driver will face any charges. Likely not, since he was stabbed as he was, you know, going back to his vehicle. Generally speaking, if you are responding to an act of a great bodily harm, you are in fear for your life, you can use deadly force. So once the driver was stabbed by his attacker, Seems to me, I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me like this is a fairly clear-cut case of self-defense. Now, one of the other questions is whether this driver is still going to have a job, right? According to CBS in Pittsburgh, driver works for Domino's. Domino's has been one of those big chains that in the past they've had a blanket policy of, if you're driving for us, you can't have a firearm. We don't care if you're a concealed carry holder. We don't care if it's your car. When you're on the clock for us, you're unarmed. That's just the policy. A couple of years ago, that started to change, along with the policies of a lot of the other big pizza shops. There's a case out of Georgia where a young woman who was driving was held up and robbed, and she was able to use her firearm to protect herself. But she worked for Domino's. Was she going to get fired? As it turned out, no. In that case, the company said, well, we leave it up to the franchisee. Whoever owns the franchise, it's up to their decision as to whether or not they want to fire the employee. She was not fired. She got a job where she wasn't driving anymore, but she maintained her employment. And then we had a couple of cases out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where something similar happened. Drivers, I believe this was also Domino's, who were forced to protect themselves. And again, the decision was not made at the corporate level, but instead was left up to the franchise owner. Do what you want. And that owner also decided we're going to keep these drivers on. So I am hopeful. We'll try to keep our eyes on any updates out of the story out of Pittsburgh, but I'm hopeful that that's going to be the case here as well, that it'll be left up to the decision of the franchise owner, and that franchise owner will say, listen, you were protecting your life. You've been stabbed. I'm not going to fire you for doing that. But as for now, we do know that this driver there in Beaver Falls, PA, today's hero of the day. Now, I mentioned we've got a couple of deals for you. First, from Delaware Online, Ogletown, Delaware. A month before a 23-year-old woman was killed by her former boyfriend, the woman told police that she was afraid that he would harm her. On Wednesday, Newcastle County Police identified Proben Morris as the killer of 23-year-old Rachel Roberts. The two had a child together. They lived together at some point. And last month, Roberts told local police that she feared Morris after a heated argument over their relationship. Since June of this year, so just in the past 2.5 months, Morris has been arrested 3 times on domestic issues. And every time he was arrested, he was allowed to leave jail without ever posting any bond whatsoever. He was let out on his own recognizance. They've been together off and on, the couple had, for at least 4 years, had a daughter together in January of 2017. Delaware Online says on Tuesday evening, Morris forced his way into a home in the Breezewood neighborhood of Ogletown, armed with a handgun. Robert's mother escaped with the child before gunshots rang out. Robert's found in the yard with multiple gunshot wounds. Proben Morris was found nearby with a single gunshot wound and a gun next to him. Delaware Medical Examiner's Office ruled the death a murder-suicide. Here's a woman again who told police, I'm afraid for my life. I'm afraid he's going to try to harm me. Had an order of protection taken out. Back on June the 1st, police were called to an apartment complex in Glasgow, Delaware. There, Robert's mom told police that she feared for her daughter's safety because of past abuse by Morris. Mom told police she had arrived at the apartment to find the couple and their child getting into a car. When she tried to pull the child from the car, Proben Morris pushed her and then struck her face, according to a probable cause affidavit seeking Morris's arrest. When police interviewed Robert's mother, she got a call from her daughter, who was crying, and pleading with her to hurry to a nearby gas station. Police got there, too. Morris was there at the gas station. He was arrested, charged with offensive touching and endangering the welfare of a child. Pleaded not guilty, ordered to have no contact with the child, with his partner or with her mom. And a week later, he's arrested again. He's already out. Again, didn't have to post any bond. He was just arrested and then released. Stay away from him. That was what police told him. I know you think that you're in the right here, but you stay away from these folks. A week later, police get a call again. After Robert's mom reported that Morris was living in the apartment with her daughter and the child. According to another probable cause affidavit, Robert's mom got a text from her daughter Roberts told police that she had allowed Proben Morris to stay in the apartment for the past week, but they had a heated argument about the relationship, and she feared him because of past abuse. So he was arrested. He was booked for violating his bond conditions. This is the part that gets me. He was arrested for violating his bond conditions and released without having to post bond. So what the hell did that do? You listen, if you're not complying with the terms of your bond here, we're going to have to take you in and then immediately let you out again. Do you want that? I mean, that's what the criminal justice system told this guy, Proben Morris. So that was, again, just a few weeks ago, back in late June. July, his attorney moves to modify the conditions of his bond, stating that Morris had the victim's blessing to do so. Proben Morris argued he was going to lose his job at a nearby ShopRite because of the order to stay away from the residence. He asked the judge to allow contact with the victim and their daughter in the apartment. Prosecutors did not oppose the motion, and it was granted by the courts on July 26th. So we're just going to send this back to how it used to be here and see if anything changes. That same day, he was arrested for a domestic incident at that apartment. Roberts told police that she was cleaning the apartment out when she heard her mom's boyfriend telling Proben Morris to leave. Her mom's boyfriend struggled to block Morris from reaching Roberts, fell to the ground. Roberts fled to the bathroom. Proben Morris grabbed her by the arm and said, "Come with me, let's leave." Police arrived. Same damn day. The court said, "Well, we're going to give this a shot here. Yeah, you can be in contact." He gets arrested, charged with two counts of offensive touching, charged with another violation of his bond, and again was released without having to post bond. Multiple opportunities for this individual to remain behind bars. Multiple opportunities for this individual to comply with the terms of his bond. And he failed to do so. And the consequences coming from the state of Delaware weren't there. There were no consequences. The consequences were, we're going to put you in handcuffs. We're going to take you on a little drive down here to this building. We're going to take your fingerprints. And then we're going to let you go. Those were the consequences. And now in Delaware, a woman is dead. Her attacker as well. When he very easily could have been behind bars, he was out on the streets. Proben Morris is today's deal of the day. Our first deal of the day. Really tempted to say the second one for Monday now because I'm just a little worked up here. But the second story from Virginia. Richmond suburb of Chesterfield. Richmond Times-Dispatch reporting on an individual named Logan Michael Osborne, 19 years of age, who allegedly tied up a 14-year-old girl and proceeded to sexually assault her. Local judge in Virginia says that Mr. Osborne will not do any jail time. September of 2017, he pleaded guilty to having carnal knowledge of the girl. Later told the court he took responsibility for what he called his, quote, poor judgment. He was originally sentenced to 10 years in prison with 8 years suspended. He was sentenced to 10 years. He would have probably had to do a little bit more than a year, and then he would have been out. But in January of this year, Chesterfield Circuit Judge T.J. Haller stayed the execution of that two-year term, said he wanted to review the case further. So hang on here. Let's just hold off on this sentence. And then Wednesday of this week, after reviewing this case for another 8 months, Judge Haller decided to stay the execution of the active prison term, citing discretionary state sentencing guidelines, according to the Richmond Times-Dispatch. A newspaper reported that the decision is, quote, tantamount to suspending the entire 10-year prison term. And the Times-Dispatch notes that this is not the first time that Judge Haller has been in the spotlight for controversial decisions regarding someone accused of violent sexually related crimes. Back in 2016, just a couple years ago, Judge Haller was criticized after he rejected the state of Virginia's request to deny the release of Dana William, who was in prison for raping his girlfriend, ex-girlfriend. He had been accused, had not formally been charged, but he was a suspect in multiple other rapes. Again, state of Virginia said, we would like to keep Mr. William behind bars here. Judge Holler said no. I think we should let him out. And he did. And Dana William then strangled to death his ex-wife's father, abducted her mom in January of 2016, killed himself as police were about to arrest him. Investigators later found the body of his ex-wife's mother on the side of the road. Back in 2009, Virginia State Senator Steve Martin criticized Judge Holler for having so many decisions overturned. Martin said, I had serious concerns. I did some research. I felt like it was best that he not continue on the bench. Now, the judge in this case, Judge Holler, in the case of Mr. Osborne, said he needed to hear some positive things about the man who had pled no contest to carnal knowledge of the 14-year-old. James Trent works for an electrical company where Osborne's been working. He commended Osborne's work ethic and performance. So the sky's the limit as far as he's concerned. Apparently that's what the judge needed to hear. Here's the thing. This is not the first run-in with the law for young Mr. Osborne. This is not a case where you can say, look, this is a 19-year-old and a 14-year-old, and he says it was consensual, and we don't really know, but, you know, this was just a dumb mistake from a teenager. Give him a second chance. You can't really make that case. According to the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Osborne has been accused. He's 19 years old. He's been accused of sexual assault 7 different times. Or sexual misconduct, I should say. 7 times in his 19 years on the planet. Including once when he was 12 years old and charged with grabbing the genitals of another student. So here's an individual who has a pretty consistent history over the past 7 years. And what happens now? Again, as far as the court's concerned, nothing happens now. Oh, sure, this guy's going to have to, you know, meet with his probation officer on occasion. Might have to take a drug test every now and then. Probably going to be told to do some sort of counseling sessions that he may or may not attend. And if he doesn't, you know what? No biggie. Because if he doesn't attend, yeah, maybe he'll get a slap on the wrist. Maybe he'll have to do a couple of days in jail, and then he'll get back out again. And if he doesn't abide by the terms of his probation, the same thing will happen. Not much will happen. No prison time. No jail time at all. The victim's family in this case said that, according to the prosecutor, they do not believe that justice has been served and share concern for community safety and future potential victims, as do a lot of other folks in the Richmond area, I am sure. All right, on to our good guy of the day, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher from WAVY, Dare County, North Carolina, in North Carolina's Outer Banks. Craig Kempinski was vacationing in Dare County. And boy, this tells you everything you need to know about the beaches at the Outer Banks, because Trooper Kempinski is actually a New Jersey State Police trooper. And rather than go to the Jersey Shore, John Pop, where did he go? He went to the Outer Banks. That's right. He knows.
Killing me.
Sorry. While he's there, just relaxing, chilling out, thinking to himself, I can take a break for a little bit. Well, you're never really off duty if you are a first responder. And Craig Kempinski's wife actually was the one who told him, hey, look out there, look out there. And he looks out in the water, and about 200 yards offshore, he sees somebody struggling for help. So he said he knew he had to get there as quickly as possible. Trooper Kempinski does have water rescue training. Used a boogie board to get out to the woman who was exhausted, could barely stay above water. He ends up giving her the boogie board so she can get on. And another paddle boater had come by at this point, and between the two of them, they were able to get the victim back to shore. According to WAVY, despite swallowing some water and being exhausted, the woman wasn't injured. New Jersey State Police say Craig Kempinski's quick actions undoubtedly helped prevent a tragedy. I have been in a couple of Outer Banks riptides. I can tell you they are no joke. But being in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, even while on vacation. New Jersey State Trooper Craig Kempinski, we thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, when we return here on Cam & Company, Sean Maloney joins us from Buckeye Firearms Association. We'll talk about another one of the good guys, the fire chief in Chesapeake, Ohio, who's quitting. He's stepping down, effective immediately, I believe, because the town says, we know that some of you are carrying firearms for your personal safety while you're on the job as firefighters. We know that you're interacting with members of the public, and a lot of times police aren't there, and there may be violent interactions. We know all of these things, but it's going to cost us like $2,500 to insure you to do that. And we don't have the money. So you can't, even if that means you are more at risk now when you go to work every day. And this fire chief there in Chesapeake, who is used to risks coming from the job, said this is one he's not willing to take, and he's stepping down. We'll talk about it with Sean Maloney right after this. So stick around. Much more Cam & Company is coming up next.
Four liberals on the Supreme Court would take away your right to self-defense.
What does the Second Amendment mean to you? It's not the right of an individual to keep a gun next to his bed.
Four liberal justices oppose your right to self-defense. Four justices support your right to self-defense. President Trump chose Brett Kavanaugh to break the tie. Your right to self-defense depends on this vote. Tell your senator, defend our right to self-defense. Confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
Speaking with Eric Frohart with NRA Carry Guard. Eric, welcome back to the program. Tell us a little bit about NRA Carry Guard.
Yeah, we just rolled out the latest iteration, the latest edition of NRA Carry Guard training here at the annual meeting. We've gone from what was in the first year, we did Carry Guard 1 and 2. We've kind of renamed our courses Basic, Intermediate, Advanced, and we also have a Scenarios-only training course.
How does Carry Guard, how does the program work?
So the program is, Carry Guard Basic is now a one-and-a-half-day indoor-friendly version of the Carry Guard training, and Carry Guard Intermediate is similar to what Level 1 was. It's a three-day outdoor version of the course, a lot more comprehensive, and then Advanced is not yet available. We will be launching it later this year. Carry Guard Scenarios training is 100% scenarios training, kind of force on force stuff, very dynamic, dynamic environment.
So why did the NRA start Carry Guard?
Well, we just wanted to, first of all, we did not start Carry Guard training to replace existing NRA training programs. It's a new offering. It's something we haven't really done. It's more comprehensive, comprehensive training. It's longer. It's a 3-day. Like I said, our what was Level 1, now Intermediate, is 3-day. $850 event. So we wanted to have something slightly more comprehensive to reach that audience that wanted that level of training.
It's awesome. How do we get more information?
NRACarryGuard.com has everything laid out. We just launched the new website here yesterday.
Eric, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and the desert warfare where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are.
And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me.
Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Tony Katz joining us in just a little bit. We do have some news out of D.C. Charles Grassley, Senate Judiciary Chairman, says confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh will begin September the 4th. You ready for that? Should take 3 or 4 days for the hearings. Now, that howl you may be hearing in the distance, those would be the howls of outrage from Democrats who have already announced that they're opposing Brett Kavanaugh, but still want to look over millions of pages of documents that will take months and months and months to compile together before they vote no. Yeah, that's their latest strategy. They've already announced, I'm not voting for him, but you know what? I just want to make it clear that I really won't vote for him. I don't think I should vote no for him until I've seen all these documents, even though I've already made up my mind that I'm not going to vote for him. Looks like Senator Grassley's not having any of that stuff. So the confirmation hearing scheduled to begin for Brett Kavanaugh coming up September the 4th. A reminder again, doesn't matter where you live, but there are some states in particular where it is absolutely crucial that your senators need to be hearing from you on this issue. Now, I want to welcome to the program right now NRA board member, also part of the Buckeye Farms Association leadership team, Mr. Sean Maloney is with us. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great today. How about yourself?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And I just thought it was an interesting story. And it really speaks to something that, you and I have talked about on a couple of occasions, the opioid epidemic in Ohio and how bad it is in some parts of the state. So Chesapeake, Ohio, you've got the Chesapeake Union Township Volunteer Fire Department. So these are already, men and women who are volunteering their time to help serve their community. Some of them have apparently been carrying firearms while on duty because they're showing up at sometimes crime scenes ahead of the police. And now the city council passed a ban against carrying guns for those on the fire department. And the fire chief, Frank Mealing II, says a human life is priceless. You can't put a price on someone's life. He's been a firefighter for more than 30 years, been a chief for the past 2 years. But after that gun ban was handed down by the city council, he turned in his resignation, Sean.
Well, I can tell you something, Cam. Now, that's a small river town right across from Huntington, West Virginia. It's right on the Ohio River. And I can tell you, my father was a volunteer firefighter for some 50 years. He was chief of the Corey Fire Department. And to have a fire chief walk away like that, that's almost unheard of. But that tells you just how much value he places on the right to be able to carry a firearm. When he's working as a volunteer. And I can tell you from firsthand, oftentimes volunteers are there many, many minutes before the police, and they never know what they're going to roll up on, especially in today's day and age with the opioid epidemic. So I feel for this fire department and for the people that are staying behind. In fact, as soon as John sent me the article, and I have to confess, I didn't read it until you guys contacted me. I did a little research, and I called the fire department and left a message for the current chief, the acting chief, and I also asked somebody from city council, if it takes $2,500 to allow these guys to protect the people and protect themselves, then my company, myself, Buckeye Firearms, or somebody's going to pay for that until we get this straightened out. And we also know of several insurance companies that we refer through Faster, because there's some insurance companies that want to raise the price of insurance to arm teachers. And I've already contacted those guys and said, hey, you know, give them a bid or do whatever you can. But let me tell you something, that's ridiculous. And I feel sorry, and I can understand almost that $2,500 can break a small community like that. But like I said, Buckeye Farms Association or myself or my company or somebody will make sure that they don't have to give up their Second Amendment rights and their right to protect themselves and come home to their loved ones every evening. We'll take care of that for them. I mean, it's a shame, and it'll help us dig down to actually what's going on there.
That's amazing, Sean, really, that you would make that offer. And I hope that the city council will accept that offer in the spirit which is intended. I mean, again, you and I have talked a lot about the budget restrictions that a lot of small towns and rural communities are facing right now. We know that it may be a very real thing, but it's also good to know that it, and again, look, it shouldn't be an impediment. And that's the thing. If the city council had said, look, it's going to cost $2,500. We don't think we've got the money. If they had gone to the town, and they said, hey, you know what, we want to have a bake sale to raise money so the fire department can carry while they're out on the job, I guarantee you that community would have raised the $2,500. You know, I mean, like, this doesn't have to be an issue, but I think the city council decided to make it an issue.
Cam, you are 100% correct. I grew up in a family where my mom had bake sales, had ox roast sales, you name it. They earned the money, they raised the money, whatever it took. And no doubt in my mind that if they would have reached out to the Firearms Auxiliary, Ladies Auxiliary, which I'm sure exists in that community, they would raise the money and they would get it done so this doesn't happen. So I don't know if these folks decided to take the easy way out or if there was something else behind it, but at least through you, we've kind of are shining the light on it right now, and we can find out and we can help if it takes help monetarily, or we can get down to the root problem and see if we can correct it that way. But none of us should sacrifice our most basic rights or our rights of existence and self-defense just to go to our job every day. You would think that, I know we've passed bills to allow paramedics and other first responders to carry now in the state of Ohio. You would think that that would apply to them, and the insurance consequences wouldn't be that severe, but it'll all work out in the end.
I certainly hope so. And I mean, you know, I want to just give you a quote or two from the former fire chief. He said, "It isn't like it was 20 or 30 years ago. You know, things have changed. The drug epidemic has gone completely wild, and you just don't know what you're rolling up on." He said, if there's a 10 to 15 minute ETA before law enforcement gets there, there's a lot of things that could happen in that time. Sometimes he says, you know, these are hostile calls. You don't know really what you're going to roll up on. It may be that you show up, you administer a Narcan to somebody who has overdosed and they're grateful that they're alive. Other cases, you deliver that a dose of Narcan and they may wake up swinging. They may wake up violent. There may be other individuals there on the premise who are violent. I mean, I was just looking at some statistics for Lawrence County, Ohio. This is from January 11th of this year. The number of people dying of a drug overdose in Lawrence County has nearly tripled in the past 4 years. But that's only part of the story. A treatment facility that opened up last year near Elwood City Hospital sees 85 patients, which is a fraction of those who need treatment. Hunter Farmer, owner of Freedom Treatment Services, says what most people don't realize is that maybe 15% of the people who should be in treatment are in treatment. It's the only disease I know of where people resist getting help. So, I mean, again, you want a snapshot of how bad things are in Lawrence County. There's a snapshot of you know, how bad things are just in terms of the opioid epidemic there. And they're not alone. I mean, again, this is playing out in counties across the country. But there are very real reasons why these first responders say they need to have a firearm for their own safety. They're not out there trying to, you know, be the Wild West firefighter or you know, they're not trying to indulge their, you know, fantasies of being, you know, Charles Bronson with a fire hose. It's about going home to their families at the end of their shift. That's what it's about.
You know, you're so right, Cam, because this is a new reality of the world we're living in. The opioid crisis, my brother in Pennsylvania, he's a paramedic and a coroner. He deals with it almost every day. And I can tell you something, their decision to carry firearms as a volunteer firefighter is based on what they see every day and the reality of what they roll up on. And you're so right. They deserve the opportunity to both protect us, do their job as volunteers, and go home at night, the same as the rest of us do. And certainly, they face new challenges and challenges that probably none of us were ever really prepared for. And maybe what the city council needs is a little bit of education. Sometimes people have their head in the sand and they don't realize what's going on and what people are dealing with. As a criminal defense attorney over the last 25 years, what I see take place in the courthouse is chilling. What has changed and transformed in the last 25 years is amazing with the drug epidemic. I was happened to be in Preble County, Ohio, which probably has, as an entire county, less people in it than the Westchester Liberty Township area where I live. And I walked in and talked to an old friend who was a judge about to retire, and I asked him how things were going. And he said, go outside and take a look at my criminal docket. There was about 18 cases, and I walked in, and he said, it's either people selling heroin, stealing to get heroin, or selling heroin. That's what I deal with every day. And every court throughout the country, every county, every township is dealing with this epidemic in their own way. And we got to make sure that we bang the drum when things like this happen, because they need our help. And certainly, speaking as a firefighter or as a first responder, your decision shouldn't be whether you're going to have the ability to go home at night. That should be a given.
Absolutely. Sean, listen, we've got to take a timeout, unfortunately, but I appreciate you coming on the program. And let us know if and when you hear back from the folks there. Will you please?
I will. I left them my cell phone number, so I'm hopeful that they give me a call. And when I sign off here, I'm going to give them another call back to see what's going on.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll be able to get an update next week out of Chesapeake, Ohio. Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms. Again, thank you for everything you do, sir.
Hey, thank you, Cam. Have a great weekend.
You too. Sean Maloney with us here on Cam and Company, and we are a segment away from the weekend. Tony Katz going to join us from WIBC here in just a moment or two. We'll have more of the day's top stories and the week's big stories. So stick around. Much more Cam and Company still to come.
Speaking with Eric Lipp with NRA Community Outreach, you've hit another milestone. Tell us what's going on.
We've reached a huge milestone. Actually had the best month of Eddie Eagle history last month. As far as the number of materials sent out to people requesting, that's going to be law enforcement and educators, daycares, libraries, hospitals, all the folks that we work hand in hand with to try to get materials to for their children and their communities whenever they need them.
They must be keeping you hopping, Eric. It's a great problem to have. The biggest month in the history of the program. Wow. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
What do you have any idea why? I mean, it's great the program continues to grow. What do you think happened here? Is a sudden spike? It's not a sudden spike in interest, but it's been growing and growing. It's great stuff.
That's right. We've had a tremendous success partnering with law enforcement, and, you know, we start talking with them and marketing to those folks here when school gets out. You know, they have a lot of kids that get out of school and have time on their hands, and they take that time to try to teach things to their community. And safety is one of the important things that is involved with community policing. We try to work with them, supply those needs, everything from events during 4th of July to other safety events, to, you know, just coming up, this happened this past week, was National Night Out, is a huge community event, and combine those all together, and you get a lot of folks that have a lot of events going on during the summer. So most of the folks that order from us are repeat orders. You know, they know what we have, they love our program, they think it helps keeps their communities safe, and they call us every year around this time, and, you know, they tell their friends, and they tell their friends, and, you know, word of mouth gets out there with a great product that has great availability. And like I said, safety is our number one priority, and that's what they're about also. So we work together, get that stuff to their needs, and they get it to their communities.
So, Eric, it's great to see this wonderful partnership between law enforcement and other organizations with you and community outreach, with Eddie Eagle specifically, but also in general. The NRA has traditionally had a great relationship and partnership with law enforcement on so many different levels. So it's great to see that, you know, how law enforcement has embraced the program. So let's take a step back for a minute, Eric, to tell folks who don't know, what is the Eddie Eagle, the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program? What's it all about?
Absolutely. Well, like I just said, it's all about safety first and foremost. But it's a firearm accident prevention for young children, pre-K through fourth grade. And everything centers around one easy, simple message. And that's if you come across a firearm, to stop, don't touch, run away, and tell a grown-up. It's a very simple safety message, something that we've done a lot of research and testing on, and something that kids can remember. And that's what's important when you come to these situations. And our partners agree, whether it's teachers, law enforcement, or even parents, we hear great things back from them and say that, hey, this message does work. My child does watch your, you know, that Eagle video or goes through our materials and they remember it. We talk to law enforcement that, you know, not only do they remember, hey, what time of year is that we need to get materials for our kids, but the kids themselves remember it. They might start in first grade, and by third grade, they know that Eddie Eagle's coming as well, and they're excited. They remember the message, and, you know, that's why we're out here doing what we do.
So great. And you guys have great online resources, tools. You mentioned videos. There's materials. There's stuff for kids. There's stuff for parents at you know, virtually. But I'll tell you, the greatest thing, and I've witnessed this a number of times myself, Eric, is to see when Eddie goes out in the community and goes to a school or goes to another organization. It's so much fun, so positive, and there's such great energy in the room whenever Eddie shows up. So that is a huge part of it as well. So, Eric, you know, it's the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. So some folks are going to think, well, why would I want to endorse or use a gun safe program that's coming from the NRA? What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, we're the only folks that do it, quite frankly. We've been around for 30 years now. Other people might say they have solutions, but they don't have anything for in hand, per se. Like you said, we have materials that are downloadable online, a video that's watchable online for parents and folks that want to do it themselves. And then just like we mentioned last month, we sent over 225,000 actual workbooks out to law enforcement. We have four different level of workbooks from pre-K kindergarten level all the way up to third and fourth grade level. So we're trying to cover all their bases and take care of them in any way we can. So that's, like I said, from print materials all the way to online stuff. And you know, trying to get materials to the parents. That's our number one goal, is trying to keep kids safe.
How can folks get more information about Eddie Eagle?
The easiest way is to go on our website. It's real simple, www.eddieeagle.com. That's where you'll find the home base for your kids so they can watch the movie there. Look at our workbooks. We have different lessons, plans, sing-alongs. And then in the top left corner, you'll see a tab that says grown-ups, and that'll take you to our other site, give you information about how to print off print materials, also how to talk to other parents as a firearm owner or a non-firearm owner. If you have children, it might be a topic that you might want to discuss with your neighbors or other people that you work with or live with. So we give information on that as well.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, and our final guest of the week. All is right with the world. We conclude with Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, on Twitter at Tony Katz with a K. Tony, how are you, sir?
I am very good. It's a lot of pressure being the last. Like, this is the last taste you have in your mouth. This is the last bite of the cake. This is the last fry in the bag. I mean, this can't disappoint.
This is the whole headliner for the entire week. It's all been building to this one moment.
Wow. We have too many opening acts. We're going to have to let people go.
Wow us, Tony Katz. Listen, we did just get the news a short time ago that Senator Chuck Grassley, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says September the 4th, that is when confirmation hearings will begin for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court. Of course, Democrats, Tony, you know, they've been asking for basically every doodle, every scribble that Brett Kavanaugh jotted down when he was working in the George W. Bush administration. The National Archives says, look, it's going to take us months and months to comply with that. Democrats say, well, we don't care. Even the Democrats, Tony, who've already said, I'm not voting for Judge Kavanaugh, are now proclaiming because they're not going to have these documents in time to go through all of these things, we should postpone a vote for Judge Kavanaugh until after the election. Not that they're going to vote for him anyway, but that's their argument.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great argument. Let's confirm them now. I mean, I don't care about their arguments. The arguments of Chuck Schumer are insignificant. The arguments of Kamala Harris are insignificant. They're nonsense arguments. They don't get to decide the timeline. Just advise and consent. Since you're going to vote no, don't even ask questions of the nominee because you don't care about the answer. Just say I'm voting no, and let's get this over with. We'll get the vote. He'll be on the Supreme Court, and we'll be one step closer to actually having justices that read the Constitution and agree that it says what it says and doesn't say what it doesn't say.
Listen, I'm with you. And it's interesting because there are some signs that the unanimity among Democrats is cracking. You know, everybody from now, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of the red state Democrats, Claire McCaskill, believe Joe Donnelly has met with Brett Kavanaugh, right?
They meet on the 15th, from okay. what I know. So they have not met yet.
They've not yet met, but it's on the schedule. It's on the calendar.
Right.
Okay.
I think in pencil. I mean, this whole thing could be erased. No one used a fountain pen. There was no quill brought out to set this appointment. You know, Siri can change it at any moment.
Indeed. But for now, anyway, next week, Joe Donnelly will meet with Brett Kavanaugh. Joe Manchin is scheduled to meet with him as well. So, I mean, do you ultimately think, Tony, that Kavanaugh gets approved with, what, 53, 54 votes? Is that where you're thinking right now?
I think that your math is pretty good there. I think that's where you are. I think you've got Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota. You've got Joe Manchin, West Virginia. Joe Donnelly. Here in Indiana, Joe Donnelly, who also said that he'll get $5 billion for the border wall and said that he voted to build the border wall on three different occasions. I mean, he's really doing what he can to attract the quote-unquote moderate voter here in Indiana. But, you know, it's what he says versus what he does. That's the real differentiator. But I think you've got 53, 54. One of the votes I'm interested in, Bill Nelson in Florida. I mean, he's in a fight for his life in the Senate race. Rick Scott is giving him a solid run for the money. I'm curious as to what he does and how that all works out. But one thing at a time. I think your numbers are right, though, 53, 54, somewhere in there.
I'm talking with our friend Tony Katz, who on Twitter has been talking a little bit about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the debate that I guess won't be, Tony. Ben Shapiro had asked Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, hey, let's debate. I'll donate, what does he say, $10,000 to charity of her choice. Even her campaign said, I'll make a donation. And the response finally came last night, obliquely, in a third-hand manner. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responded to, I believe it was Ryan Saavedra, and said, in essence, just like those who catcall me on the streets, I don't believe that every utterance deserves a response. So, in other words, she's not going to debate Ben Shapiro on socialism because she'd lose, Tony. But that one move to try to, you know, get her base all excited about her not debating somebody on socialism was to proclaim that inviting somebody to debate on socialism is the same as, hey, baby, nice rear end.
Well, sexism works, right? Racism works. Class warfare works. She'll tell you this herself. This is who she is. If you say to people, yeah, call me a socialist, I don't give a damn. Her words, not mine. Well, then this is the road you're going to go down. This is somebody who is absolutely a believer in the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie. That's the 99% versus the 1% conversation that Barack Obama had. Different language, same thesis. It's all Marxism. So it's not surprising. Here's the question that nobody's asking, and I did ask on Twitter. Who would she debate? You won't debate Ben Shapiro. Mm-hmm. I think Candace Owens from Turning Point said, I'll give you $20,000. You can't use that sexism stuff with me. And I would have to advise Candace that you can't use that sexism stuff with anybody. That doesn't work on me. It doesn't work on you, Cam. I don't think it would work on Ben Shapiro at all, of course. You can't use it on anybody, just so we're all clear. But if you won't debate Ben and you won't debate Candace, who will you debate? The question has to be asked. She once said that Republicans are so scared of her ideas. And then when a conservative, Ben, says, I'll debate you,
she says, why are you catcalling me? Now, that wasn't me coming, you know, putting that together. That was Bridget Feste on Twitter, if you know her, and it was really, really smart. And that led to my question, who will you debate? I would like to know, and I would love a reporter to ask Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who would you debate on the merits of your idea?
You know, and here's the thing. So the political answer would be I will debate the Republican who's running against me, if there is one, and there might not be one. The political answer could be I'll debate Republicans when I get to Congress, right? I think it was a political mistake for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to say I'm not going to debate Ben Shapiro because I'm not going to take this seriously. This is like being catcalled. I think that was a very it was just dumb politics, honestly.
No, the nonsense part of it was the connection to the catcalling, right?
Yeah.
Because she made it now about sexism as opposed to the policies. She said that Ben Shapiro isn't worthy of her time, or it was the dehumanizing, if you will, of Ben Shapiro. That's the story there. That's the issue there. Now, I may not be a big fan of the first overture from Ben to begin with, only because what answer did you expect? But my goodness, the beauty of Ocasio-Cortez is that she never disappoints in the answer. There is no place you could think of the craziest answer in the world that she can't say, hold my beer. It is remarkable that every chance she gets, she gives an answer that's so surreal, one wonders why they put her in front of a camera to begin with.
Yeah, you
if
know.
This is the best. I mean, this is really, this isn't socialism. This is silly talk. This is a silly person engaging in silly talk and knows some catchphrases, but doesn't understand her position. She doesn't understand what she's doing.
You know, and it's interesting because you do raise a really good question of will she ever even, I mean, beyond even a debate, will she ever do a tough interview? You could say Margaret Hoover from the new Firing Line asked her some tough questions. She was on with Chris Cuomo on CNN the other day and you know, gave a completely ridiculous answer to a question. But the problem is, Tony, in those situations, it's not a debate. And frankly, I think in some cases the hosts worry about looking like they're dunking on her. And so they actually hold back. I mean, Chris Cuomo let her rattle on for like 2 minutes without interrupting, without interjecting. You never see that on cable news anymore. But I think he was just, okay, I'm just going to let her keep talking here. I mean, the honest answer is she doesn't want to debate anybody who actually knows anything about socialism or about economics because she would lose that debate. She's a very high profile candidate right now. There's no upside for her debating anybody on socialism. What would she gain from doing that?
And that, by the way, is a great answer. And that is very, very true. She has nothing to gain. And the interesting part is that nobody wants her to debate. They just want to accept what she's saying as good and decent. They don't want her to have to prove her thesis. Better just give her the platform that allow her to continue these lies and this nonsense, and then more people will talk about the nonsense. And then when you push back on the nonsense, you're catcalling. It's a remarkable 1-2 punch that they've developed. My only advice is don't buy into it. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez may be a lovely person. She may be a great daughter. I have no idea. I only hope that's the truth. But she's not bright, and she proves it every time she talks. She might win. She might get people to believe the lies, but when it comes to explaining a position, she can't do it. And if the key to socialism is not explaining your position, which it is, well, then she's the greatest ever. But some people might want to know how these things get paid for, and they might want to know how it affects their lives and the lives of their kids. And when it comes to that, her entire world falls apart because she has no idea of what she's saying to what it means to the real world.
Well, and again, in the real world, the candidates that she endorsed and she backed, in the vast majority of cases, at least in this week's primaries, they failed. And it wasn't even like, you know, any of them really ran close. I mean, that's the thing. You know, the media treated Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as if she was some huge star because she knocked off the number 4 Democrat in the House in a district that is roughly 80% Democratic. Right. And the question wasn't look, she still beat the number 4 Democrat in the House. She beat an established politician. That says something about the campaign that she ran. That says nothing about the ideas in that campaign transferring, as you say, to political success in much of America. I mean, how would socialism run today in Indiana?
I want to disagree with you. It has nothing to do with how she ran a campaign. It has everything to do with the inmates running the asylum in the Democratic Party. They want this. They want the most left candidates out there. Marcos Melitza said on Meet the Press that if Democrats aren't embracing socialism, they will be left on the fringes like Andrew Cuomo, on the outside looking in, being irrelevant. That's the reality. It has nothing to do with the campaign she ran. What, she invented a strategy no one ever thought of before? You know what? Yard signs. What the hell did she do with a campaign that has the world writing books? The Ocasio-Cortez strategy. No one. Absolutely no one. You couldn't write a pamphlet about that. There are second-grade books that have more consonants and vowels than could explain her great campaign strategy. The inmates run the asylum. The Democrats have created the monster, which is now this socialist wing of the party. They can't rein it in, and they would like to have some people who aren't 80, which is why you're hearing about how much trouble Nancy Pelosi is in and how she might not be the leader. And if you listen to that Cortez answer about Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the House, literally her head might as well explode. She can't answer the question. It is a crazy word salad. I would have her checked immediately for any head trauma.
Again, talking with Tony Katz from WIBC here on Cam and Company. All right, Tony, we've only got about a minute left here on the program, so we will let you get to the Freedom Deck. You got any plans this weekend?
There is a cigar in my future. That much is happening. You know, we've launched the full second show. There's the 3 hours. You can get the third hour at TonyKatz.com and get the podcast. So we're doing even more and a couple other tricks in store. So I'm trying to get the rest when I can so I can stay busy and hopefully employed in this crazy world.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, listen, buddy, I appreciate your time today, sir. As always, look forward to doing this again soon and enjoy your weekend.
You got it. Take care.
All right, Tony Katz. Make sure you're following Tony online on Twitter at Tony Katz, Tony with a T, Katz with a K. And a reminder again that coming up next weekend, we've got the Bass Pro Shops Centenary Night Race in Bristol, Tennessee, Bristol Motor Speedway. We do want to see you there. It's going to be an incredible event. NRARaceTix.com. That is the website where you can get your tickets. And as if that wasn't enough, we also have coming up here in a little more than a month, the NRA Carry Guard Expo in Richmond, Virginia, just down the road from us in Farmville, September 14th through the 16th. You can find out more information. You can sign up and register at NRACarryGuardExpo.com. Yeah, coming up in just about a month, all kinds of great opportunities to learn more, to train more, to become more over the course of a weekend. All right, that music means we've got to scoot. You enjoy your weekend. Be safe. Have fun. We will see you back here Monday live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV for the Monday edition of Cam and Company.